And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. So much to get to. All the shenanigans going on over in the Ukraine. Going to spend a lot of time on that tonight. A lot of folks saying, hey, could this be the new Cold War? You know, it just seems curious to me that while we're talking about doing away with some defense spending, maybe not building an aircraft carrier or, you know, looking at some of the jets and stuff, that this kind of pops up. It just kind of makes one curious. Kind of makes you think a little bit about how this all maybe came about. Now, you've got the Lindsey Grahams of the world. And this is the thing that gets me. Opportunists in the Republican Party. Opportunists who, you know, at the first sign of crisis, like Sarah Palin running around, I was right. Look at me. Hooray. I can see Russia from my window. Look, you know, it doesn't take a genius to look at Putin and go, here's the guy who wants empire. It doesn't take a genius to figure out this is the guy who would love nothing more than in his legacy to be that he rebuilt the Soviet Union. I mean, to be honest, you look at it, is anybody surprised? And the answer is no. I've been reading a whole bunch of stuff on this. Initially, my thought, you know, right when the whole, all the protests and all the stuff went on in Kiev, and, you know, I started looking at it, I just kind of stepped back and go, you know, in the old days when I was a kid, and maybe it goes back to my when I grew up, thinking that, you know, you had these two polar powers who were always pushing and pulling over something, always having this back and forth. They never took each other on head to head. It was always using these third parties as the push and pull. I'm going, are we right back there again? So we're going to talk a little, probably a lot about that tonight. You know, then look at, you know, the cost. What's the cost of war? You know, let's say we decide. I've heard already some voices going, wow, we need to put Putin in his place. Not very loud voices, mind you. But you've got some crazy people out there going, wow, we need to put him in his place. And, well, not alone. And I guess we have some sanctions started. We're cut off some military exercises, cut off some trade talk stuff. So it'll be interesting to see where that gets us. So that will be on the agenda. Also, it's war on the poor time, since we're a good war society. Yesterday, the president came out with his budget. It wasn't as austere and wasn't as painful as I'm sure the GOP would like. So Paul Ryan came out with his piece today. We will talk about that as he continues to cherry pick in the war on the poor. And I guess the easiest way to put it is when you start from a place that the war on poverty was an absolute failure and that any intervention whatsoever just makes things worse, when you start from that position, it is of no surprise to anyone that the end result will be that you have no use for any of the programs that are going on. So we'll talk also about that. It is Dr. Seuss's birthday, so America Reads Week across the country. I know my kids were thrilled with the day of reading, but then again, my kids read an awful lot anyway. Just another good example and a good excuse for them to sit down with a good book. My favorite Dr. Seuss book by far has always been Oh, the Places You'll Go. My favorite by far, because it is just as a matter of life, it is so spot on, and one of those things that, you know, I just really that's my Dr. Seuss book, and also one of the other things maybe we'll get to maybe, and thank goodness we're going to get to it, folks in Kentucky, I guess it's Bowling Green, Kentucky, they're going to be okay, the Corvettes in Kentucky will be just fine. So all the middle-aged guys who their heart, you know, kind of stopped for a second and ran off to the ER, you can breathe a little easier. The Corvettes will be okay. You may remember I talked about the Corvettes that sunk through the big sinkhole, 60 foot deep, 40 foot wide, sucked up. I think it was 8 of the Corvettes. Well, they're starting to pull them out of the ground. And Chevy has said that they will make sure that they restore them. So there you go. Good, good, good all the way around. Such happy news. Also going to take your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You can email me anytime during the program, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Twitter, @ricksmithshow. Facebook, facebook.com/thericksmithshow. All of that, good ways to get a hold of me. If you call into the program, the auto attendant will answer and say, hey, hold on, he'll be with you in a minute. And I will. So don't hang up. So good. Here we go. Let's start off right from the beginning. Lindsey Graham tweeted out that it started with Benghazi. When you kill Americans and nobody pays a price, you invite this time this type of aggression, hashtag Ukraine. Let that sink in for a second. The idea that we're, now these are the war hawks. These are the people who want us bombing everything all the time. This is what it is. These are the people who think we should be the imperial nation that goes around and bombs things. I look at what's going on in the Ukraine, and you could have called this a while ago, and I think a lot of very smart people did. But we don't have many options. We don't have very many ties with the Russians. We don't have very much leverage. We have no troops in the area. This is, from its inception, not something that I think had anything to do with Benghazi. Maybe Syria, I don't know. But not Benghazi. But this is the stuff that drives me nuts. It's all about inflaming the base. It's all about getting people all riled up and all lathered up. I remember when I was a kid, the hostage situation had gone on. And, man, they had – I was in sixth, seventh grade at the time. And I remember kids in my classroom going, we're going to go in there and kill those you-know-whats. And I'm going, maybe we should think of something else. Because I've actually seen people get killed. You know, there's something – there's something about seeing the life come out of somebody's eyes when a hole is bubbling the life out of their chest that you kind of don't forget. And then maybe you're not so keen on rushing into. And I find it interesting. It's the folks who they've never really seen that stuff are the ones who want to send poor people into it. And I go back, and anytime I talk about war stuff, I come from my perspective, being a kid growing up in a housing project, which was basically a war zone. But the only people that I ever saw coming back from the military, and now my kids have a very, very different view of the military living where I do in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, home of the Army War College. They see very professional, very well-dressed, very uptight, very, very educated military people. I saw the guys who were broken, battered, beaten, and left like trash on the side of the road. That's what I remember. And it's one thing to see the military in a positive light. I remember that negative light. So anytime we start talking about war, I remember, I've seen people die. I've seen the life go out of their eyes. But I've also seen those guys who have come back broken, bloodied, beaten, with horrible drug and alcohol problems, horrible mental health issues. And we don't want to take care of it. So, when we hear these calls, tonight I'm going to talk to someone about, what's going on with the Vietnam vets? What's going on with the first Iraq war vets? What's going on with Afghanistan and the Iraq war vets here recently? What's happening to them? If we can't take care of the people that we've already harmed, why would we be talking about the future in more of this? What gets me, and I'm sure it's been said before, we're willing to go into deep hawk to go make big rocks smaller. But when it comes to making sure that vets coming back have jobs, have homes, or families are taken care of, that's a bridge too far. And for me, it all comes back down to our economy. And our economy, especially here in Pennsylvania, has been in the tank. The recession may be over on paper, but I still know hundreds of people in my life that are struggling to get by day to day, that they're worried about the next week. And our economy here locally, nothing good. And I look at the latest release by the folks at the Keystone Research Center. They've come out with some new analysis of the state of our economy here in Pennsylvania, and it ain't good. Nothing good there. And you look at the top guy, the guy who's sitting in the governor's mansion, kind of got to blame the policies that come from him. When our guy took over, when Corbett took over, we were seventh in the nation in job creation. Somehow we've fallen to 48th, according to the research done by the folks at the Keystone Research Center, while the state unemployment rate has remained at or above the national average since the middle of 2012. Because we fared a little bit better than the national average right after the collapse. Then it came down to bad policy. And for me, that's why I think this election coming up is so vitally important. It's the policies put forth. And you know, you look at education, you look at investment in roads and bridges and investment in our infrastructure. That hasn't happened. We've decided as a matter of policy. Now, this comes down to you and me, folks. This comes down to us making these decisions, saying, well, what's our priority? Is our priority more pain, more suffering, more cut and gut? Is that the priority? Or is the priority investment? Because as I'm seeing it, this governor really hasn't done much to get us out of the hole that, honestly, he didn't entirely create, but he's made worse. And then you got to ask the question down the road, as we got money from education, as we got money from future investment, what really then happens? What are we saddled with? What are we left with? What's the end result? And, you know, in the months, years, and decades ahead, you gotta wonder. We got $1 billion of education each of the last 3 years. $1 billion. Cut 20,000 education professionals. You've heard these numbers over and over again, but it's gotta sink in that there's a long-term cost. It just isn't today. And while these job numbers are bad, an uneducated workforce tomorrow is worse. And I can't be the only one who sees this. I can't be the only one who thinks that this is a bad direction. I just can't be. Anyway, tonight, going to take your calls, your thoughts, your comments, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, therickschmithshow.com. The website, if you want to watch online, you can see me flailing my arms around. All of that, email rick@therickschmithshow.com. Twitter @RickSmithShow. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers President Ed Hill is urging the NLRB to decide for the UAW in the VW Chattanooga plant elections appeal. The UAW wants the NLRB to set aside the results and order a new election. The union says workers could not vote freely due to threats from Tennessee politicians that voting for the union would economically hurt the plant. IBEW President Ed Hill says that his union stands side by side with the UAW in condemning what Hill calls, quote, the gross violation of public trust by the most powerful people in the state, end quote. Hill says the NLRB must protect the right of American workers to decide for themselves how to get the wages and benefits they deserve and the respect they are due. Hill says the NLRB must not reward blackmail. Wisconsin Republicans on Monday held a hearing on a bill that would essentially bar cities and local governments from enacting their own living wage ordinances. The Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice of South Central Wisconsin was among those testifying against the bill. Becky Schiegel is acting director of the coalition.
It doesn't on paper void ordinances that cities and counties might make or have made, but what it does is say that you cannot use any state or federal funding in paying wages that you are using on a city contract to uphold a living wage. And because they're talking about shared revenue, it essentially then does make, in fact, local living wages void.
Siegel says the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice acts on behalf of workers because many major world religions teach justice for workers.
Statements about the dignity of work, about paying fair wages, so many faiths have this, and we come together in a coalition to say in this, in the dignity of a worker, in having a safe work environment and paying people fairly, and of course in trying to lift up people out of poverty. This we all agree on.
On Wednesday, Chicago working families are joining business owners, healthcare practitioners, and Chicago aldermen to call for paid sick days for Chicago workers. The City Hall rally is coming at a time that 82% of Chicago residents support earned paid sick time, according to a recent poll. The paid sick day supporters say 460,000 Chicago workers, 42% of private sector workers in the city, have no paid sick days. That puts workers at risk of being fired or losing pay whenever they're too sick to work. AFT President Randy Weingarten says a new European three-year nursing workforce study confirms that patients die every day because there aren't enough nurses to care for them safely. The RN forecast findings published in Lancet underscore that safe nursing staffing levels reduce medical errors, hospital infections, and patient falls. Weingarten says corporate hospital staff cuts have made the nurse staffing crisis worse. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So that American dream that, you know, when I grew up with as a kid, that if I get a, if I can get that job, if I can work hard, I play by the rules, I'm going to do okay. I'm going to be able to support my family. I'm going to have a better tomorrow. Sadly, that seems to be going away. So you look at the latest numbers that I just talked about. I'll put out by the good folks over at the Keystone Research Center. That pointed out, look, you know, 48th out of the 50 states in job creation. Something is wrong. And when you realize that something is wrong, you look to where who's the reason why it's wrong. And I got to be honest, I got to blame the priorities of our governor and that whole idea that, well, if we just keep tightening the belt, things will get better. Well, eventually, if you tighten the belt, you cut off circulation and you die. But that's just my thought on it. Here to talk about his candidacy and run for the highest office here in Pennsylvania, I've got Tom Wolf, one of the gubernatorial candidates. Tom, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. It's good to be here.
You know, I look at these numbers. When the governor took office, we're seventh in the nation in job creation. We are now, according to the good folks at the Keystone Research Center, 48th in the nation. To me, that's policies put forth by the guy sitting in our highest office.
Yeah, I'm stunned by those numbers also. I mean, I guess there's theoretical issues that other people might disagree with you and me on, but the numbers make it look like not only is this not working, in other words, we're not creating new jobs, but we're actually destroying jobs, and that's what's troubling about this whole thing, that it seems like the rankings that the Keystone Research Center pointed out, you know, going from 7th in 2010 to 48th, I mean, you know, maybe it was 15th back in 2010 or 10th. But this kind of a drop suggests that the rest of the country and, you know, the economy has not been strong over the last 2 to 3 years anywhere in the United States, but to actually be bringing up the rear in a relatively, stagnant economy nationwide. This is really troubling.
Especially given the fact that our governor keeps running around saying we're the Saudi Arabia of the United States. If really, honestly, and truthfully, if this boom is here, if we're in the midst of this huge economic boom, why aren't we seeing it? especially in tax revenues.
Yeah, we're not seeing it there. We're not seeing it in the job numbers. You know, maybe there's some secret number that is the administration's holding that we aren't seeing, but I don't see evidence that things are getting better, and in fact see a lot of evidence that things are getting worse. I mean, the emperor has no clothes, and someone ought to point that out. Now, I know this is partisan here, and it's my job to point that out, but frankly, it seems to me that that's the truth.
You know, the reality is there are folks that I talk to every day who, you know, look, they like anyone else, they've been told that you work hard, you play by the rules, you're going to do okay, you're going to get ahead, you're going to be able to maybe achieve that American dream. But sadly, you know, I'm just not seeing it. And I come back to policy. We haven't expanded the Medicaid expansion, haven't taken that money, which could create up to 40,000 jobs, I've seen. There's no talk in Harrisburg about giving low-wage workers a boost. Any of the policies that I think could stimulate the economy, they've all shied away from.
Yeah, and you didn't include, I mean, the Keystone Research Center report included education funding as one way, and maybe a longer term, but an investment in creating those kinds of jobs. Because when we train and educate our fellow citizens, we're creating the raw human capital to actually take the jobs, to attract entrepreneurs to Pennsylvania who are going to create the jobs or create the positions that our citizens can fill. So we're not investing in education. So we're not investing in the long-term opportunity for people to take jobs. We're not investing in things like transportation or infrastructure where we could actually create jobs very quickly to do good things, create public goods that we can all use and would make our economy stronger. We're not doing things like creating the supports for middle class, like minimum wage. I mean, I think Representative Kim's bill is a good one, but I'm not sure that this administration, I don't think this administration sees much merit in that kind of a thing. So we're not doing that. And the middle class is vanishing, and as middle class vanishes, people who can buy stuff vanish, and as people who can buy stuff vanish, people who want to make stuff also vanish.
People like
me, I want a good, strong middle class because I want people to be able to buy my products. And that's what makes for a healthy economy. That's what makes for a healthy society. And there are good public policies that states like Pennsylvania should be pursuing to make sure that we have a strong middle class and that we have people who can buy my products.
See, we keep hearing this, we have to be business friendly, like it's somehow exclusive. Being business friendly is somehow exclusive to being worker friendly or society friendly or investment friendly or future friendly, that somehow it's tip of the nose, only business. This is what we've got to do because this is the only thing that works in their world. Are they mutually exclusive? Can we be business friendly and worker friendly too?
I don't think we can. We have to be. I don't see that you can separate those two things. I mean, there are places in the world that have tried it. We've tried to have workers' paradises, and they haven't worked out so well for capitalists or business people or consumers. Actually, they haven't worked out so well for workers either. And we've tried to have consumer societies, and they haven't worked out so well for manufacturers or business people, and they haven't worked out very well for workers either. And we've tried to – there are places in the world, I guess, that have had to try to play put the business as the only place. Maybe that's what Pennsylvania's doing. And it hasn't worked out so well for consumers or for workers. So I think the logical place for all of us to go is for a place that all of us work at, that we optimize the interests of consumers, of workers, of business people, and that everybody has an incentive to try to do the best we can. And if we optimize that, I think that's the best outcome for all Pennsylvanians. And I think anybody who tries to just maximize one set of interests is going to end up with a very weak economy. And I think that's what we have here in Pennsylvania.
I agree. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Tom Wolf, Democratic gubernatorial candidate. His website, wolf4pa.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Tom's name. It'll take you there. You can also check out his Twitter feed at wolf4pa, Facebook, facebook.com/wolf4pa. Well, we've got links at thericksmithshow.com. You know, I've been following this story about these huge electric bills. The people who bought into the variable rates, you've seen their rates skyrocket. And to me, I go back to the 90s talking about deregulation and all of this, which seemed to me at the time more a bad idea. I look at this and I go, something's got to be done on the commons, on things that you and I and all of us need. One political view is we privatize everything. And I look at the electric situation and go, this is what happens when you deregulate and then eventually down the road privatize, this is the world we end up with.
Yeah, I think one of the eternal verities of American history, of any history, is a strong debate over what is and what is not a public good. And I think we can all understand that the definition of a public good can change from generation to generation. But there is a place for government. There is a commons. And the idea of electricity, for example, when we were universally focused on central distribution points, central generation points, we chose to look at those as public goods, public utilities that were to be regulated by the people. And that was sort of the mix of private, public good that we did, and that seemed to work pretty well. Now, we deregulated electricity rates, and theoretically that you could say, okay, that could possibly work out to the better. Competition might mean lower rates. But in a situation like that, you still have to have some regard for the well-being of the consumer. And the consumer, too often in this new deregulated area, has gotten hurt by unscrupulous, I guess, providers or sellers, resellers, who are sort of giving teaser rates, blocking people, sucking people into a certain assumed rate, and then jacking up the rates very shortly after things have been over, or you know, not having them read the fine print in the contract. There's a reason we obviously want people to be control of their own destiny. We want them to make decisions. We want to make decisions on our own. We want that freedom. But there are limits. There are also, I think, limits that we want to impose on people who are providing services so that consumers don't get raked over the coals. And I think that's one of the concerns here, that what might be theoretically useful has turned out to, in practice, hurt a lot of people, and that shouldn't have been the intent, and the outcome is something that we really ought to pay some attention to. So I agree with you. It's a concern. We really ought to look at what's happening as a result of the way deregulation has occurred in Pennsylvania, and what can we do to make it so that this particular public good or private, whatever it is, not being served to the consumers in a way that harms them.
Yeah, my problem with this is, you know, as we've deregulated things, and I've been on the air just about 9 years now asking, what have we deregulated, what have we privatized that has actually done well for the consumers, for the taxpayers? What's benefited us? And I know it's benefited a lot of the Wall Street types, the investors, and those such, but I don't know about the average everyday folks who need these things. I don't know that they've benefited from anything, and no one's in almost 9 years has come up with anything that's been viable. And I look at this and I go, as we're moving towards privatizing education, I have some serious concerns. You know, just looking at deregulation of the energy, all the other things that we've sold off, I have serious concerns.
Yeah, I share your concerns. I think there is a mania for privatization that is just unwarranted. Are there some things that maybe healthy competition could provide an advantage over heavy regulation? Absolutely. I'm sure that there are areas we could all identify where competition would be better. But it seems to me that there's this sort of mania right now that privatization in every situation is superior to the public good, and that's just not true. And public education, you mentioned as an example, I think is a great example of that. Public education is actually a public good, not a private good. If it were a private good, I wouldn't care about the education of your children. You have children, right? Right?
Yeah, three of them.
Yeah. If it were a private good, I wouldn't care about the education your children got. But it's a public good. And the reason it's a public good is because I do care. If I'm smart, I should care about the education your kids get, because if they get a good education, my life is made better. My economy is going to be, Pennsylvania is going to be stronger. And that's why we all support education, because it's in our self-interest to do that. I care about the children in Philadelphia, even though I'm a Yorkanian. And I hope they care about the education my two daughters got in the public schools in York County, because it matters to them. And that's why we fund it as a public good. And I think we don't remind ourselves of that enough. And so we allow this sort of mania for privatization in all cases to take over, especially in areas where it's just really inappropriate. And again, there are a lot of areas, and we can certainly discuss which areas are appropriate for privatization or not, but public education is one that I think we ought to stick to it as a public good. That's why I'm against privatization of the lottery, against privatization of the state stores. These are things that we share, we ought to do together, and I think we ought to keep them where they are.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, I look at my kids, and my sixth-grade daughter sits in a class, an LGI class, and I had to, well, what's LGI? It's large group instruction. She sits in a class with 100 other kids.
Wow.
In sixth grade, you're sitting in a class with 100 kids. Yeah, well, you know, we do this and that. I go, do you learn anything? Well, you know. And I go, this is not, it's not what I remember going to school. And now, you know, it's been a while since I've been in sixth grade, but I remember taking college classes that were less than 100 people in the class.
No, I think you're right. I don't think our study halls were that big when I was in school.
And this is a direct result of the Corbett budgets. This is a direct, you know, I talked to the girl who works at the gas station next to the station here, who, you know, they're cutting the cosmetology program, and there are going to be girls who don't get to go through this career path, which, you know, they've been looking to do for, you know, for the last several years. So that is going to be cut off. Why? We haven't invested in their future. And what's that going to mean to those kids down the road now that you've taken this life opportunity away from them?
Well, and it gets back to the point you started with, which is the job situation in Pennsylvania. I mean, the things we're doing here really are going to affect, as these kids go through the education, they're going to make us less able to take the jobs of the 21st century economy. And it's going to, you know, create this continued downward spiral. We have to invest in the public goods that make Pennsylvania attractive for people who are going to create good jobs. And we've got to have the skills here. We've got to have the entrepreneurs, we've got to have the public goods here to make sure that this table in Pennsylvania is set to ensure the creation of the kind of jobs that you talked about. You play by the rules, you do everything you're supposed to do, that at the end of that process is a good job waiting for you. And if you're an entrepreneur, it's a good business opportunity. It's a place you want to take good, healthy risk. It's a place you want to have innovative ideas. It's just a hotbed of creativity. That's what Pennsylvania should be. And good public policies make that happen. Just look at some of the states in the country where good things are happening. And we should be one of those states. And we need good public policies to get there. Education's key to that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of the other things. We've got the location. We've got natural resources. We've got the human capital and an education yet that isn't completely destroyed. So I think it just takes the right guy in the right place to get us moving in the right direction.
Well, I'd like to be that guy, but I think you're right. This is a place. Pennsylvania is a state of a lot of low-hanging fruit. If this were a business and instead of running for governor, I was looking at a place, you know, with real investment opportunity, really good bones. This is a place, Pennsylvania. You mentioned the location. It's a God-given resource. The resources that lie beneath our feet. We have lots of them. We have a big size. We have great people. We have a great work ethic here. We have great cities and universities. Wonderful, glorious history. I mean, there's so many things to like about Pennsylvania. This should be one of the dominant states in the United States in every category, including job creation. This should be one of the wealthiest, most prosperous economies in the country. And to show up 48th on any list, especially a list of jobs, and job creation, and to see this as a decline, something that's been declining, where we've been getting worse, not better, over the last, you know, 3-4 years, that's disheartening.
So what do you do to bring more jobs here? I mean, one of the things I hear from my conservative friends is that Pennsylvania has by far the highest tax rate in the industrialized free world, according to them, even though 70% of the corporations pay no state tax. What do you do to draw people here? What do you do to keep businesses here? What would Tom Wolf do?
Well, I have four things. And first of all, I was Secretary of Revenue, so actually I have some expertise on tax issues. It's true that the C corporation tax rate at 9.99% is the second highest marginal tax rate in the United States to Iowa, I believe, and the highest average tax rate for corporations in the United States. And that is outrageous, and I think Democratic governors and Republican governors have felt that way. But the truth is that, as you said, a very large number of C corporations don't pay that tax because they find all kinds of neat loopholes. But even a bigger thing, a lot of companies that could do this, even when I was Secretary of Revenue, have been shifting their charters from C corporation to an S or a pass-through, different types of pass-through corporations that pay at the personal income tax rate, which is among the lowest in the country, 3.07. So in terms of business taxation for any businesses in Pennsylvania, they actually pay one of the lowest tax rates in the United States. So I don't think taxation is a reason for that. I think it gets back to some of the things that you and I were talking about. My policies would be leveling the playing field. Let's take things like the C corporation tax code and make it much fairer. Eliminate the loopholes, make it lower, and make it attractive for businesses to be here, but make it fair. Broaden the base of taxes like that to make sure that we're bringing in the revenues we need, but we're also doing it fairly. Second, I would invest in education. I think we need to restore the $1 billion that the Corbett administration cut, but we also need to make the education funding fair. That means a smaller reliance on the local property tax, but also reminding ourselves that this is a public good and a very important one at that that we ought to invest in. So education is a key. In Pennsylvania, you mentioned the location. We're the Keystone State. We ought to be investing in transportation infrastructure that is fit for a 21st century economy. And I understand we have a transportation bill now, and I applaud the legislature for you know, biting the bullet and doing that to get to the point where we can fix our bridges and, you know, fill in the potholes, but that's not a transportation strategy. I am, for the record, I am for fixing the bridges, but we've got to go beyond that. What should a 21st century infrastructure look like? And if we had the right one, it would pay for itself. It would be a great investment. It would take our fields, and agriculture is still the number one industry in Pennsylvania. It would take our fields closer to the markets of New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington. Transportation would connect the different regions of the state together more seamlessly. And it would take advantage of this Keystone State location so that stuff and people moving from the East Coast ports to the Midwest or from the Midwest to the rest of the world through the East Coast ports, they'd have to come, those things would come through Pennsylvania. And on a 21st century transportation infrastructure that would be, would pay for itself, would actually bring jobs, would actually bring revenues and resources to Pennsylvania.
Go ahead.
No, then I think finally, I think we ought to take responsible from an environmental point of view, but also financially prudent advantage of our natural resource, the gas that lies beneath us. Let's take advantage of that. Let's do it so that we're actually regulating it, trying to do it as safe a way as possible, and then let's put a severance tax on it. 5% would generate hundreds of millions of dollars that could go for regulation, could go for local beef up local resources and distribute money to localities that wanted to do this kind of thing. It would help us fund some of the things that continue to build a bridge to some sustainable energy future. And a lot of it could go to plugging that hole in education and a nice down payment maybe in our transportation system. There are lots of things we could do with that resource, including creating some very, very good jobs in Pennsylvania, but we have to do it right. So those are, I think there's things that we can do to create jobs. I've created jobs in my business, a lot of, in a bad economy. So I know how to do it, and I know that there are bright people with good ideas that can create good jobs who understand that we have to do this in partnership with the people we work with. But we can do it in Pennsylvania. We have the right place, the right natural resources, the right raw materials. We just have to have the right public policies.
And then it comes back down to the I word you kept using. So the last question I've got for you, you know, you, as a business person, right now is the time to roll out the dreaded I word, invest. Invest in all the things you've talked about, especially when rates are as low as they are, even still today. It seems ridiculous that we haven't done those kind of things that you laid out, that we haven't done that kind of investment.
I agree. The things I'm talking about are not expenditures as much as they're investments. And investments, we all, Pennsylvanians, all of us, should expect a return. I mean, that's fair. You don't cut your way to prosperity. You don't cut your way to a profit in the private sector. You don't cut your way to prosperity in the public sector. You invest in the future. You invest in those things, and you expect a return, and I think that's fair. We're just not doing that. We have a bright future for us. All we have to do is take it. And Pennsylvania especially has a bright future, but we've got to invest in it. We've got to do something to make that future come about. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with a future that is very dim, and it's going to be more of what the Keystone Research Center produced today. It's just a continued downward spiral. We don't want to do that. That's not what Pennsylvania should be about. I think it's time to stop that downward spiral.
No, I'm with you. And I don't want to stop it at the bottom. I want it to stop, but not at the very bottom. And I want it to go back up.
Yeah, we can't get too much lower, I don't think. So let's turn this around. We should be one of the dominant states in this country, and Pennsylvania should be a leader in innovative ideas. We need to start investing in our future, not destroying it.
Right there with you. Tom, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Rick. It's great being here.
Anytime. Tom Wolf, Democratic gubernatorial candidate. Wolf4PA.com, the website, if you want more information. You can also follow him on Twitter, at Wolf4PA. And, of course, the Facebook, facebook.com/Wolf4PA. We've got links at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Tillerson is mad. In fact, fracking mad. This 61-year-old farmer from Bartonville, Texas, is another victim of big oil's fracking boom that's invaded people's homes and lives from upstate New York to Southern California. Polluted air, contaminated water, depleted aquifers, multiple health problems, and even an inexplicable epidemic of earthquakes are a few of the side effects caused by this massively destructive drilling process. But the frackers had not counted on Rex getting mad, speaking out, and suing the bastards. What ticked off Tillerson was the erection of a 160-foot-tall water tower built by a company that can provide millions of gallons of water for fracking gas wells. But Rex is no environmentalist, so his objection is not to the waste and contamination of people's water, nor does he object at all to fracking. Rather, he's hopping mad because the 15-story tower stands above the tree line on his 83-acre, $5 million horse farm, spoiling his view. Tillerson, you see, is not just some local dirt farmer. He says he and his wife moved here to have a weekend getaway so they can enjoy the rural lifestyle. He's not a farmer at all, unless you count farming the government and harvesting billions of dollars in special tax breaks and subsidies. Rex, whose name means king in Latin, is the $40 million a year CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, guess which oil giant is the biggest fracker in the USA? Right, ExxonMobil. This is Jim Hightower saying, so what we have here is a case of phallic justice, an upright, cylindrical water tower that's part of the fracking infrastructure, symbolically extending the middle finger salute to Exxon CEO every time he visits his horsey farm. How fitting that a guy who's gained a personal fortune from the ugliness of fracking now has some of that ugliness right in his face.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, health... Healthcare workers, parole agents, you may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. I mean, I look at those numbers, man. 48th in the country. 48th in the country in job creation. And who do you blame for that? Honestly, who do you blame? You blame the guy at the top. Like it or not, reality or not, he's the guy who set the policy. He set the agenda, set the tone. And what we've been told for the whole 3 years of this guy's term, if we give all of this money to these big corporations, if we say, here's the money, they'll come. And then we see these big check ceremonies. Oh, we brought such and such a company from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, over to Easton. Granted, no new jobs. The same people are working there. They just shifted borders. And where'd that money come from? Came from our kids. And I bring it up often. My daughter sits in a class, a large group instruction is what she tells me. Look, I don't go to school with her. She tells me there's 100 kids in her class. I've been in the auditorium where they have their I shouldn't call it an auditorium. It's a lecture hall. You know, like when I was in college, it was a lecture hall. You know, you had it was a big weird shape. And everyone sat spanned out around the front desk, which was the beginning of it, and you listened to lectures. In sixth grade. Serious problems with this. It comes down to though, you know, that lack of investment. And speaking of lack of investment, according to the folks at the National Employment Law Project, congratulations, Congress. Today, you've now hit 2 million people who have been gutted from the Unemployment Insurance Compensation Program, the Emergency UC Program. Now, those are folks who they went 26 weeks, couldn't find a job, and then they went beyond that. Where the federal money kicked in, where the emergency money kicked in. And thanks to Congress, who, you know, they went away for Christmas and said, Merry Christmas, folks. You'll get nothing from us. And almost immediately, they left 1.3 million people without that lifeline, without that income to keep the lights on during the wintertime. And this is what gets me. During the wintertime. Think about that. While they're off doing their Christmas thing. Now, by April 5th, according to the National Employment Law Project, that 2 million number could hit 2.3 million by April 5th if there's no way for the Democrats to appease the Republicans so that they'll drop their filibuster. This is where we are. This is the reality. We've got a political party. And I wish it wasn't so. I mean, it is what it is. We've got a political party that is holding the nation hostage, holding working families hostage. And for what? For what? Because I think it's horrible, horrible for business where people don't have money in their pockets. I just think it's absolutely horrible. And these are the same people who turn around and go, oh, you know, it's those welfare people who should go out and get a job. Okay, well, you know, how about encouraging there to be growth in those areas? You know, where I grew up as a kid, we didn't live on the bus line. So the jobs that you had locally were very, very minimal. Where's the helping hand? Instead of just pointing fingers and saying, wow, you're the problem, or lazy, stupid, like our governor does. You know, those unemployed people, first they were lazy and stupid, and then they were drug addicts or alcoholics or whatever. Can't pass a drug test, I think he said. You kind of got to wonder. So yesterday, Paul Ryan, who you got to love the ultimate in poor sportsmanship. When Romney and Ryan lost in 2012, said the reason that they lost is because Obama was giving stuff to the urbans. You know, the urbans, those people. Well, he didn't disappoint. He came out with a 204-page report on the effectiveness of our war on poverty. You know, the anti-poverty programs that came out during the war on poverty. What it's supposed to do, it was supposed to be the kickoff of him revamping the federal welfare system, which he called counterproductive and ineffective. In fact, it went on to say that the programs have actually contributed to the nation's high poverty rate. According to the article, according to the report, federal programs are not only failing to address the problem, they are, in some significant respects, making it worse. You know, because it's dependent states, nannies! You know, we've heard it. What I find interesting, and Igor Volsky over at Think Progress went through the 204-page propaganda piece and pulled out a number of parts from the Ryan report that points out that, you know what, your premise, when you start off from the premise is that the government can't do anything right, like the old Ronald Reagan, about the 9 most terrifying words in the English language, I'm here from the government, I'm here to help. Remember that? Well, Igor actually went through and came up with 16 examples how, in Ryan's own words, the government did and can help lower-income Americans make ends meet. He points out the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest single single-payer health insurance in the country. He goes to the child tax credit, which helps millions of families with kids, to make sure that they have a minimum amount of money. The earned income tax credit, which helps particularly low-income single mothers. The rural housing assistance grants, which help repair and improve rural housing units so that people have a decent, safe place to live, especially low-income elderly homeowners, living on a fixed budget, as Ryan points out in his thing. The Title X family planning stuff that, makes people think about, hey, can I afford to have children? Which I think is a very good thing, which I think it's odd that Ryan would focus on. And he goes into a number of other things, the Ryan White HIV AIDS program, the housing opportunities for people with AIDS. There's some of that stuff that he says actually, it's effective and, could actually help, the vulnerable population. And maybe we might think about keeping some of that. And, you go on to the low-income subsidies for people who get Medicare Part D, the maternal and child health services block grant, a lot of this stuff, because we'd like to reduce infant mortality rates. If you're going to be pro-life, should be a decent idea. The supplemental nutrition program, the SNAP program, women's infants and children, that stuff actually says, most of the academic literature supports the WIC program increases birth rates for low-income women, actually does something good. Now, this is from somebody who says that none of this stuff is any good. It's all bad. We've wasted money on all of it. He also picked up on the school breakfast program, which, according to him, increases both nutrition and academic achievement among low-income children. The report even says that it doesn't seem to increase the likelihood that children will eat breakfast. I look at this. And there's so many, education for homeless children and youth. There's a whole bunch of stuff in this. The Child Care and Development Fund that helps low-income families afford child care. Lots of stuff in this that actually make people's lives better. But they paint with this broad brush. It's all bad. It's horrible. And in fact, to make his point, the news came out today, thanks to the people at the Fiscal Times. They reported that some of the authors of the research that Ryan cherry-picked, forgot, left out, ignored, omitted, whatever word you want to use, lied, just forgot, however you want to put it, some statistics that actually showed that the anti-poverty programs worked exactly as they were intended. And one of the most glaring things, because, they're saying, hey, he left off a whole bunch of data, from one of the two most one of the studies that showed that the two most successful years of Johnson's war on poverty, 67 and 68, were just left out of the data. Because Ryan says that 1969 on, you saw almost no drop in the poverty rate, which, understand, you from 1967 to 2012, you saw a 26% poverty rate in 67 down to 12%. Now, you take 67, 68 out, the 2 years when really the program kicked into full gear and they were really doing well and funding it. This is, you know, the Vietnam stuff really started to hit and sucking money out of it, which harmed it. You cut those 2 years off. It doesn't look like that big of a deal, but you put those back. Understand, a quarter of the population, more than a quarter of the population, lived in poverty. And then one of the women who did some of the research, she said, it's technically correct, but it's an odd way to cite research. Said there's no justification given. She said it's unfortunate because it really understates the progress we've made in reducing poverty. Here's the thing. That was the intention. That's the point, to underestimate what has been done. Because, look, very few of us were alive and cognizant back in 67. I was born in 67. But I know what those programs did in my life. I know what that helping hand did in my life. And I saw what Reagan did when he took office. And he went and he destroyed all of those programs. And we've actually made poverty much worse since the Reagan years. Now, Ryan also points out that the 1996 welfare reform caused a decline, is what they're saying, in child poverty. That, we pushed those welfare mothers into the job force, and poverty was declined. That's what they're saying. Ignoring the glaring expansion of the earned income tax credit and the glaring booming economy. I guess it's easy to forget those things. I guess it really is. But understand, when you start from the point of all of this is bad, is it surprising that you would cherry pick? Is it surprising that you wouldn't find anything in a federal program that you think is good, is reasonable, is effective? I find it ironic from a guy whose father passed away, much like my mother did, and was able to collect Social Security benefits, the survivor benefits, that actually helped put him through school. I find it really ironic and more disingenuous than anything, that you would then look back and go, wow, none of this stuff works. We should do away with it. Don't you find it a bit troubling? Don't you find it a bit interesting that this is what we get from this guy? I know it sticks in my head. And for me, the Johnson War on Poverty was an enormous success for all of the millions of people that were helped by it. The millions of kids who didn't go to bed hungry that night. The millions of kids who were able to have a meal. I'm telling you, these people will destroy anything. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers President Ed Hill is urging the NLRB to decide for the UAW in the VW Chattanooga plant elections appeal. The UAW wants the NLRB to set aside the results and order a new election. The union says workers could not vote freely. due to threats from Tennessee politicians that voting for the union would economically hurt the plant. IBEW President Ed Hill says that his union stands side by side with the UAW in condemning what Hill calls, quote, the gross violation of public trust by the most powerful people in the state, end quote. Hill says the NLRB must protect the right of American workers to decide for themselves how to get the wages and benefits they deserve and the respect they are due. Hill says the NLRB must not reward blackmail. Wisconsin Republicans on Monday held a hearing on a bill that would essentially bar cities and local governments from enacting their own living wage ordinances. The Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice of South Central Wisconsin was among those testifying against the bill. Becky Schiegel is acting director of the coalition.
It doesn't, on paper, void ordinances that cities and counties might make or have made, but what it does is say that you cannot use any state or federal funding in paying wages that you are using on a city contract to uphold a living wage. And because they're talking about shared revenue, it essentially then does make, in fact, local living wages void.
Schiegel says the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice acts on behalf of workers because many major world religions teach justice for workers.
Statements about the dignity of work, about paying fair wages, so many faiths have this, and we come together in a coalition to say in this, in the dignity of a worker, in having a safe work environment and paying people fairly, and of course in trying to lift up people out of poverty. This we all agree on.
On Wednesday, Chicago working families are joining business owners, healthcare practitioners, and Chicago aldermen to call for paid sick days for Chicago workers. The City Hall rally is coming at a time that 82% of Chicago residents support earned paid sick time, according to a recent poll. The paid sick day supporters say 460,000 Chicago workers, 42% of private sector workers in the city, have no paid sick days. That puts workers at risk of being fired or losing pay whenever they're too sick to work. AFT President Randy Weingarten says a new European three-year nursing workforce study confirms that patients die every day because there aren't enough nurses to care for them safely. The RN forecast findings published in Lancet underscore that safe nursing staffing levels reduce medical errors, hospital infections, and patient falls. Weingarten says corporate hospital staff cuts have made the nurse staffing crisis worse. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Tell you, I'm seriously going to miss Michelle Bachman.
Yeah, you got to love crazy, and I do. I'm sad to see her leave. I really am. You know, I'm sad, especially where she said, I don't think a woman can be president. I don't think the country's ready for that. Did anyone tell her that she was actually running for president? Just a thought. Anyway, the big news. In case you were worried, I know some of my Corvette aficionados are very unhappy. About a month ago, we talked about this. Big sinkhole opened up in Bowling Green, Kentucky, about 60 feet deep, 40 feet wide, sucked up 8 classic Corvettes, just sucked them right into the ground. Today, they pulled some of them out. And Chevrolet says that they're going to restore them to their former glorious luster. So there you go. 60 foot deep, 40 foot wide. Big sinkhole. Nobody knows why. They still haven't come up with a reason why. I'm still waiting. And you look at Harrisburg, sinkhole capital. Bad infrastructure, which is why we need to be investing heavily, much like we talked about earlier in the program with Tom Wolf, the Democratic candidate. Running for governor, but here to talk to us about what's going on in Harrisburg and what we can be doing to fix some of those potholes, our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director for the Pennsylvania Laborers International Union of North America. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome, Rick. Good to be with you.
So, 8 classic Corvettes, 60 foot deep, 40 foot wide, big hole in the ground, just sucked up. They're out of the ground now.
How about that? I'm wondering what each of those was estimated at, Rick. I mean, I know that some of them were considered to be really rare specimens, but, I'd like to know what the cost of that was.
Well, I mean, the 1992 one, the white Corvette, the 1 millionth Corvette made.
Oh, my.
And, you know, when I thought about this, when I heard about it originally, I'm going, well, who's going to, normally they just throw a bunch of stuff over top of it and seal it up. But I'm going, these are Corvettes. They're going to risk someone's life to go in there. And my wife said, what they're going to do is they're going to pull the Chevys out and fill it with Fords. Because I'm a Ford fan. It is what it is. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, you look at this, and these sinkholes we seem to be getting more and more of. And I don't know if it's just we're hearing about them more often or if it's happening more often. But I look at Harrisburg, every time you turn around, there's another sinkhole that swallowed something.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the weather has something to do with it. But, of course, I mean, you're looking at infrastructure that has not been updated in more than 100 years, Rick. When I sat on the transition team, this was 4 years ago now, We did a big study on what was actually underneath the streets in terms of the sewer lines, in terms of some of the transportation systems. And, brother, I mean, we're talking about stuff that has not been updated. We're talking about brick casings for sewer lines. I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, we're talking about the old-time London days, what we found. And you have to put money into ailing and aging infrastructure so then it doesn't crumble to the point where it actually can kill people. And that's what we're experiencing in the city of Harrisburg, no doubt about it, and throughout Pennsylvania as well. You've got to put money into these investments, and you've got to be willing to spend it on people who know what they're doing in terms of fixing it. And that's one thing that this governor doesn't understand clearly. In fact, Rick, he got knocked around by the Wall Street Journal, of all things, last week, saying that his accomplishments were nil, that they were flimsy, and the one solid piece of legislation that came out of his administration, supposedly, was not being touted. I mean, here's a guy that just doesn't get it. He can't catch any breaks whatsoever. And it's just another reason for him to go, I mean, at the end of 2014, Rick. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. He's got nothing to point to. He has a staff that does not help him much in terms of publicity, public relations. And when the Wall Street Journal knocks you around in an editorial, man, if you're a Republican, it's time to go.
No.
I mean, that's bad.
Now, I wouldn't be surprised if they could try to rescue something out of it and bring back Lynn Swan.
Yeah, he's out there somewhere, isn't he?
Sitting on the Hershey board the last time I checked.
Well, I'll tell you what, Rick, his numbers, his popularity is probably going to be a lot higher than Corbett's right now. I mean, this is ridiculous. Yeah. I've never seen anything like it. And, of course, they're going to pull out all the stops. There's anyone who thinks that this is going to be a cakewalk is going to be sadly mistaken. He's going to have $30 million at his disposal. I was talking to people, Rick, today, who were not happy with any of the Democratic candidates because they wish to tax the Marcellus Shale. Of course, they're all laughing at us because they're not being taxed at the level that they should be or the level that they thought they were going to be. They're taking that money. They're taking that difference, and they're pocketing it.
Yep.
They're laughing all the way to the bank. And so they're saying, well, you know, we're going to stick with Tom Corbett. Well, no kidding you're going to stick with Tom Corbett, who doesn't want to increase taxes in any way, shape, or form. And then the reason why he's not talking about transportation, Rick, is because that's going to have a tax increase involved as well. But, you know, when you sign that no tax pledge by Grover Norquist, you immediately become indentured to the right. And there's no wiggle room whatsoever. So what do? You get the troops jazzed up, and you get people lined up to say, oh, this guy didn't raise our taxes while he was in office. Yeah, but guess what? He didn't do a darn thing either for you.
No, that's so true. And destroyed your kids' education.
How about it? That's exactly right. $1 billion cut and unwilling to put anything back. Although it was interesting to see, Rick, that this last budget had a little bit for everybody. It had money in there for teachers. It had money in there for pre-K. It had money going to the Philadelphia School District.
Yeah.
I mean,
you do know it's a campaign year, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is just so transparent and so lame that even the friendly writers throughout the state of Pennsylvania have caught on to it. And they basically say, look, I mean, the guy's in trouble. He's got to pull out all the stops, but nobody's fooled.
You know, here's the thing that gets me when you go back to the Marcellus Shale. And, you know, my wife has a relative who lives in Anchorage, Alaska. And he tells us, you know, every year he gets his check from the state of Alaska,
mm-hmm.
Which is the money that from the taxes from the oil that go through the pipeline. And, you know, he kind of thanks my wife for buying oil, because we're paying Alaska's taxes. We're giving them money. And for me, it seems ridiculous that we're not letting anyone else pay our taxes. Because understand, the gas doesn't just stay here in Pennsylvania. We're not actually buying most of it. So
right.
Wouldn't it make a lot of sense to go, okay, we'll put a tax on it? Because the drillers have already worked that into their business plan.
That's right, Rick. That's exactly right. They've already worked it into their business plan. What they're doing right now is they're laughing at us because they have so much on paper and so much that's being taxed. And what are they doing? They're taking that difference and they're pocketing it.
Yep.
They're laughing at us. And of course, I mean, they want to keep this going. And the governor, who got $3 million in terms of the contributions from the gas industry, I mean, wait till you see what that's going to be this year. I'd say it's going to be five times as much. You know, it could be as high as five times as much.
Well, they better.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I talked with Eddie Dave Pashinsky, Pennsylvania State Representative,
yes.
not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he estimated per year us not taxing just at West Virginia levels.
Because mm-hmm.
We're actually pulling West Virginia down. Figure that one out. But he's saying it's in excess of $400 million a year we're leaving on the table for these drillers. And I'm going, $1 million in campaign cash gets you $400 million?
That's amazing.
How do I get that return on investment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That return on investment is that's incredible. I mean, that's Wolf of Wall Street money right there, Rick. I mean, it's insane. Absolutely insane. So they're going to pull out all the stops, and they're going to make sure that his coffers are padded and he's taken care of in terms of dollars. And he's going to continue to say, no, we can't tax these guys because they're going to start leaving Pennsylvania. Really?
Yeah.
Are you serious? You've got those reserves, and underneath those reserves, Rick, is another rock formation called Utica which is called... Marcellus Shale on steroids. They're not going anywhere. This is generational work. You're looking at least 25 to 30 years of work, and they're not going to walk away from that. So tax it accordingly.
Yeah.
Raise the necessary revenues for the state.
Yeah, but didn't you see the secret memo?
Which one?
The secret memo that says they're going to drill from China.
Unbelievable.
They're going to come from China. So they would, if we raise the tax, they're going to go to the other side of the world to get the stuff because,
oh,
you know,
please. You know, again, you can't
I'm
make
being
this
facetious.
Stuff up, Rick. Yeah. But you know what? I mean, I wouldn't put it past them. Their sound bites are so ridiculous these days. And I put nothing past these guys. I mean, the clown car is in town and everybody's staring at it. I mean, this is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting election season, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Things are kind of quiet right now. You know, the legislature is just wrapping up its budget hearings, and they're going to come back into session next Monday, which is the 10th. And so we're going to start seeing a lot of things. And of course, one of the things that we're keeping an eye on is House Bill 1507, which, of course, is the paycheck destruction bill that the right has been pushing. And as you know, the Koch brothers, I mean, they pump money into other states, and they were looking at doing something in Pennsylvania. And you know, Rick, what makes me nervous is that they're all saying that nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when they say that and people rest on their laurels a little bit, bad things can happen. And what my real concern is that these guys are going to push this thing after the election in November, during a lame duck session, and hopefully we'll have a lame duck governor in place, but he's going to be able to sign that if he really wants to. And there are going to be a lot of people that won't have bullseyes on their backs because they're retiring at the end of the year. And that's where I get a little
I'm with you.
Concerned.
Well, what we're seeing is the setting up of what happened in Michigan.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so we have to be vigilant. We have to let everybody know that this is unacceptable at every level. We want this thing dead. I mean, just squashed and buried deep into the ground. We can't even consider this popping up again in the fall. And I know that organized labor is doing its due diligence and meeting with legislators on a daily basis and getting letters out to their members and then informing everyone that this is unacceptable. This is the first step in what could be a cataclysmic piece of legislation and really bad public policy, especially for working families in Pennsylvania.
I'm with you. You know, I look at today in history back in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson in his inaugural address, the famous statement, take not from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. And yet every time I turn around, what I'm looking at is I'm looking at, and mostly Republicans, but some very conservative Democrats, pushing law, pushing legislation, doing just that, taking from the working people and handing out and tax breaks for drillers or subsidies for companies to move jobs overseas. It just seems very backward to me.
It is, Rick. It really is. And, you know, unfortunately, we live in a society where everybody wants to be rich. So, you know, they start favoring those who have the resources and forget about the little guy.
Yeah.
And that's wrong. It's just wrong.
I'm right there with you. So what can we do on 1507? What's the push? What are we doing? Because I showed up at my local state senator's office, and she wasn't there. But I left I left my name, left my number. I haven't heard back.
You know, we've got to stay on top of them because no one gets a free pass. You're either with us or you're against us. There's no in the middle here. There's no, gee, I'll get back to you on this. No. They've had enough time to deliberate upon the issue. They got their information. They got their sound bites down. I'll tell you, this is not something we can fall asleep at the switch on. And, yes, there have been several legislators who have not met with anybody. And those people need to have a bullseye on their backs, figuratively, of course. You know, we need to continue to reach out to them. We need to call them. We need to write to them. We need to email them, let them know that we need an answer from them. They can't hide. They don't have the luxury of ducking and hiding on this issue. We've got to make sure that that our folks have the ability to meet with them and get a straight answer. I mean, we have been meeting with people in force. I mean, we're talking about 10 or 12 people at one meeting talking to legislators. I've been to some of those meetings. They've been very civil. I mean, they've been very reasonable. And when we explain our case, you know, some of the folks that we didn't think were with us surprisingly came on board and said, you know, you make a lot of sense. We don't want this. And so this is where we're hearing the patter of, oh, this is just going to go away. This is going to die. But, again, I get a little nervous when there's nothing to be nervous about.
As my grandfather always said, when you least expect it,
That's expected. That's exactly right, brother.
All right, Abe, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
You got it. Thank you.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director for Pennsylvania at LIUNA. Quick break, right back. Stick around. This is another Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We are covering the Tariff Act of 1883 that taxed imported vegetables and the U.S. Supreme Court case that it spawned. After the Civil War, Southern tomato growers successfully lobbied Congress to impose a tariff on vegetables, which made their tomatoes cheaper than the imports. Importers were not pleased, and one of the biggest, John Nixon Company in New York, sued Edward L. Hedden to put a stop to it. Mr. Hedden was responsible for enforcing collection of tariff duties at the Port of New York. He was just a political appointee, but he was now a principal party in a creative American lawsuit. The case landed in the U.S. Circuit Court for the Southern District of New York. It was Nix versus Hedden, filed in 1887, that would have an impact as recently as 2005. Join us again to see whether a tomato is a vegetable or a fruit. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Rex Tillerson is mad. In fact, fracking mad. This 61-year-old farmer from Bartonville, Texas, is another victim of big oil's fracking boom that's invaded people's homes and lives from upstate New York to Southern California. Polluted air, contaminated water, depleted aquifers, multiple health problems, and even an inexplicable epidemic of earthquakes are a few of the side effects caused by this massively destructive drilling process. But the frackers had not counted on Rex getting mad, speaking out, and suing the bastards. What ticked off Tillerson was the erection of a 160-foot-tall water tower built by a company that can provide millions of gallons of water for fracking gas wells. But Rex is no environmentalist, so his objection is not to the waste and contamination of people's water, nor does he object at all to fracking. Rather, he's hopping mad because the 15-story tower stands above the tree line on his 83-acre, $5 million horse farm, spoiling his view. Tillerson, you see, is not just some local dirt farmer. He says he and his wife moved here to have a weekend getaway so they can enjoy the rural lifestyle. He's not a farmer at all, unless you count farming the government and harvesting billions of dollars in special tax breaks and subsidies. Rex, whose name means king in Latin, is the $40 million a year CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, guess which oil giant is the biggest fracker in the USA? Right, ExxonMobil. This is Jim Hightower saying, so what we have here is a case of phallic justice, an upright, cylindrical water tower that's part of the fracking infrastructure, symbolically extending the middle finger salute to Exxon CEO every time he visits his horsey farm. How fitting that a guy who's gained a personal fortune from the ugliness of fracking now has some of that ugliness right in his face. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm an innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm down on my luck. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Always interesting to talk to Abe. Always a good conversation. I mean, you know, the reality is we've got a government right now that I don't think Corbett, I don't think the Republicans really know what they're doing yet. I think they're election kind of shocked. I think Lynn Swann would have a better shot than Corbett does right now because they have so badly boogered things up. I mean, really, look at the job creation numbers in the tank. So it's all of this other diversion stuff. It's all of this other stuff outside of actually creating jobs. Explain to me this, and I talked a little bit about this last night. This idea that you've got now two Republicans, Chris Ross, the Republican representative, and Senator Pat Brown, Republican, who have proposed making payday lending legal, basically doing away with the state's 24% interest rate cap, saying, you know, it's the Wild West. Go ahead. If you can get somebody dumb enough to pay you 300% interest for a short-term, two-week loan, that's what's good for business. Explain to me how that's going to help our economy. Explain this, because I'm struggling with the priority. I'm struggling with the idea that somehow this is good, that this is good policy. Because it's not. It's horrible, horrible policy. And yet, what we have are we have people who are saying, you know, well, you know, Rick, this would be good for poor people. Think about that. Think about the wasted energy, the time, and whose coffer gets filled. It's campaign season. Need to get that campaign cash. Pennsylvania is one of only 15 states in this country where basically loan sharking, call it what it is. It's loan sharking. When you look at the numbers I've seen on it, you could pay upwards of 300-400% interest over a short period of time. And then the fees and everything that accrue on top of this, because there's very little regulation of it, as I understand it. You know, you go into, and this was one of the things that we figured out as we did our cross-country labor history tour. You went into neighborhoods that were not so great, You know, kind of like when I was a kid growing up in the projects, I guarantee that there's probably, that there's one right there now. Because it's where people are desperate. And if you're throwing a desperate person, you know, you got somebody who's drowning, and you throw them an anvil, they're probably going to grab for it. Because it's something. Only to realize that that's going to take them faster down to the bottom. That's how I see this. But it's curious to me that here we are pushing something that I think most experts agree is bad for us. It's bad policy. It's bad society. Now, if we want to have a system that says, you know what, if people need short-term loans, maybe, you know, I saw Elizabeth Warren came up with an idea. Maybe have the post office do it. Maybe have an ability to have short-term loans that are tied to actual rates. I don't know, but I'm telling you right now, Senate Bill 975, bad, just bad, but still being pushed. And you got to go, why? And what's interesting to me is you went to some of those areas that had fairly high poverty rates. And there were a lot of them. So it's got to be lucrative. And I don't know that the industry would be spending as much money to try to get into Pennsylvania if it wasn't. I mean, think about the future that the Republicans are pushing for us. Stop and think about this with me. They want to privatize the wine and spirit shops. They want to bring in loan sharking, this payday lending stuff. They want to privatize the lottery. I mean, we're talking vice central. We're talking, let's take advantage of people who are down and desperate. Let's take advantage of people who are grasping at whatever is available to keep them from drowning. And let's throw them an anvil while we're at it. Think about this. We're going to go into neighborhoods where all you're going to see are liquor stores and cash now places. Is that the society we want? And, of course, let's not forget the lottery machines on every corner, especially in the high poverty rate areas. To me, this is just ripping off the poor and making things worse. And you know what gets me is over the summer, German of the Republican Policy Committee, David Reed, made a big thing about his Empowering Opportunities Initiative. They were going to go across the state and look at poverty and find the causes. You know, like being born, that one bad decision. Have you heard anything lately? Have you heard any good policy? Do you think loan sharking is going to help? Again, is it going to help make poverty better? Or worse, I would argue, and I believe rightly so, it would make things considerably worse. So when I saw that whole, we're going to do our poverty, and you got to give them credit, at least they played poor for an hour. They played the I'm poor game. Oh, I can't pay my bills this month. Oh, that's horrible. You know what? It's fun to play anything. But the reality is when you look into your kid's eyes and go, I can't afford to put food on the table. When you look into your kid's eyes and go, you know what? I can't afford to buy you new shoes. Or you know the kid is cold, I can't turn the heat on because we don't have the money to pay the bills. That's real life. And this nonsense of, oh, we're going to play? Ridiculous. To me, it comes down to policy. It comes down to smart investment, smart policy, done by smart, caring people. And I hate to generalize, and I hate to look at the Republicans and a good number of Democrats and go, these are people who don't care. But the reality is, poll after poll has shown it. Our leaders, our political leaders are out of touch, which is why I'm in favor of using our right to term limits and throwing the bums out. Bring new people in. Bring people who are closer to reality, and it is that simple to me. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. You know they're going to push us around.
Mr. Pep can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, 'cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground. Mr. Tap can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Tap can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, 'cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers President Ed Hill is urging the NLRB to decide for the UAW in the VW Chattanooga plant elections appeal. The UAW wants the NLRB to set aside the results and order a new election. The union says workers could not vote freely due to threats from Tennessee politicians that voting for the union would economically hurt the plant. IBEW President Ed Hill says that his union stands side by side with the UAW in condemning what Hill calls, quote, the gross violation of public trust by the most powerful people in the state, end quote. Hill says the NLRB must protect the right of American workers to decide for themselves how to get the wages and benefits they deserve and the respect they are due. Hill says the NLRB must not reward blackmail. Wisconsin Republicans on Monday held a hearing on a bill that would essentially bar cities and local governments from enacting their own living wage ordinances. The Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice of South Central Wisconsin was among those testifying against the bill. Becky Schiegel is acting director of the coalition.
It doesn't, on paper, void ordinances that cities and counties might make or have made, but what it does is say that you cannot use any state or federal funding in paying wages that you are using on a city contract to uphold a living wage. And because they're talking about shared revenue, it essentially then does make, in fact, local living wages void.
Schiegel says the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice acts on behalf of workers because many major world religions teach justice for workers.
Statements about the dignity of work, about paying fair wages, so many faiths have this, and we come together in a coalition to say in this, in the dignity of a worker, in having a safe work environment and paying people fairly, and of course in trying to lift up people out of poverty. This we all agree on.
On Wednesday, Chicago working families are joining business owners, healthcare practitioners, and Chicago aldermen to call for paid sick days for Chicago workers. The City Hall rally is coming at a time that 82% of Chicago residents support earned paid sick time, according to a recent poll. The paid sick day supporters say 460,000 Chicago workers, 42% of private sector workers in the city, have no paid sick days. That puts workers at risk of being fired or losing pay whenever they're too sick to work. AFT President Randy Weingarten says a new European three-year nursing workforce study confirms that patients die every day because there aren't enough nurses to care for them safely. The RN forecast findings published in Lancet underscore that safe nursing staffing levels reduce medical errors, hospital infections, and patient falls. Weingarten says corporate hospital staff cuts have made the nurse staffing crisis worse.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the big news that my wife pointed out to me this morning is that the Humane Society of Lebanon County, they're going to hold this, I guess this Saturday, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., an Adopt-a-thon, also a craft and vendor sale fundraiser kind of thing for the Humane Society at the Ebenezer Fire Company there in Lebanon to find a home for some 27 animals. That were found living in a car with a veteran who was homeless. That's and sought medical care. And my first thought was, that's great, fantastic. I love the fact that you're finding these kittens and these dogs and these animals' homes. But what about the veteran? What about the cause of these animals being there? What about that? And again, it takes me back to my childhood when I saw those guys coming back from Vietnam who were just dumped into my neighborhood. And immediately, when you start thinking about what's going on in the Ukraine, you start hearing about, you know, the drums of war again, you know, not very loudly beating, but still some voices out there. It kind of makes you take pause, which is why we've asked John Grant. He is with the Veterans for Peace Chapter 31 in Philadelphia, Vets for Peace, Phila.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. He's also a journalist with the publication This Can't Be Happening .net. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Okay, great to be here, Rick.
You know, I see this story that caught my attention this morning. That, you know, we're finding these animals' homes, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But I think about all the hundreds of thousands of homeless vets across this country, and not just vets, but homeless people in general.
Absolutely. I used to work with feeding the homeless in Philadelphia back in the 80s and 90s, so that's a perennial problem. And certainly veterans who end up in the street is a terrible condition. I would also add the veterans in prison. I work with a couple of groups involved in incarcerated veterans and a number of Vietnam veterans with post-traumatic stress who that was not recognized in their sentences back in the 70s and things like that. So there's a lot of problems that linger when veterans come back from wars. So as we always say in Veterans for Peace, wars are easy to start, but very, very difficult to stop. And I think we're at a moment now where we can kind of see that dynamic at play with this situation in the Ukraine and, of course, in the southeast part of Ukraine, the Crimea area, which the Russians are very covetous of, whether the United States and Western Europe was aware of how much of a tinderbox that might be when we spent all this energy and things in stirring up a lot of the opposition to President Yanukovych, who in no way is defensible. He sounds like an absolute disaster of a leader. But anyway, the situation has been set off, and now we realize how important it is to Russia and Vladimir Putin, coming off the Sochi public relations heights and all this very nationalistic resurgent kind of interest in Russia. It's a pretty volatile confrontation that suddenly has happened here. You know, people are talking about a return of the Cold War, and probably the worst thing that we can see happening is that, you know, we get people like Senator John McCain and his friend Senator Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham talking about creating a democratic noose around Russia by getting countries like Georgia into NATO and all this, which doesn't help. Steve Hadley, a former worked with George W. Bush, said he wants to get Ukraine and get them into NATO, which is a preposterous idea. And so you have all this provocative sort of talk about calling the President of the United States impotent, inept, and all this kind of thing. At the same time, the same people were calling him a dictator the day before.
Yeah, that's the interesting.
So it doesn't help when you have a situation that everyone in the world will benefit from by cooling down and ratcheting down to have all these lunatics on the right, attacking the president. So not that I'm always a defender of Barack Obama.
That makes two of us.
But I look at this. That's kind of the way I see it.
But here's the thing that I look at, and you look at people like Graham and the voices on the right who would want to push us into conflict or whatever. And
right.
You're generally the folks who are at the back going, okay, go ahead, stupid, you go ahead and do it.
Yeah,
and, you know, look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it seems that it's always the poor that shed the blood. It's the poor who die in these conflicts. And I remember guys coming back from Vietnam, as I said earlier, that were just dumped into my neighborhood with horrible drug and alcohol problems.
Draftees, a lot of them,
yeah, and just, you know, broken bodies, broken minds, and dumped. And, you know, the sad thing is I look at what's going on with the Iraq and Afghanistan. We're not seeing the same. I don't see them in the streets, but that doesn't mean they're still not there.
There's a tremendous, I don't know what the figures are, but they're astonishing. You know, the suicide rate of Iraq and Afghanistan is just absolutely incredible. These men and I assume women, you know, minority women, are, you know, killing themselves. In other words, there's something untenable about their lives after they come back from something like Iraq. And, of course, I don't think you can discount the idea that the Iraq war is pretty much agreed by everyone, Democrats and Republicans, was an absolute unnecessary, useless war. And, in fact, arguably turned Iraq over to our allies of our worst enemy, Iran.
Yep.
So, you know, to actually go on 2, 3, 4, even 5 tours in these places to have horrible things happen to you, do horrible things, have traumatic brain injury and all this kinds of stuff, and then to come home and to realize the consensus in the country is that it was an absolute waste of time, and energy and blood and treasure. And, you know, what is a troubled young person gonna do? It's like, it's a disaster.
No, I agree. And, you know, the sad thing is I think it was during the President's State of the Union, they had the guy there who had done 10 tours.
Wow, yeah, and he was a basket case. I hate to say that, but I mean, he was admirably, he was a very strong individual, there's no question about it, but he was obviously very much messed up. And it was, you know, it was moving. He was very moving.
But I look at that and I go, no one should be asked that.
No. And that's why, you know, we need to take the lessons of, I'd say, the Vietnam War as well, besides Iraq, as, you know, I think the Vietnam War was absolutely unnecessary. And people like Harry Truman should be called on the carpet for that. Why this war in 1945 was set off through the French and all this. An absolute disaster of a war that divided this country, devastated Vietnam when you know that wasn't necessary, and so take the lessons from these unnecessary and terrible tragic wars and put them to use them right now when we see these wars. This being stirred up by people like McCain and Graham, and you know, John McCain should be ashamed of himself. You know, as a pilot and a prisoner of war, to be so saber rattling. He should not be that kind of person. He should be a person to say, wait, let's not go to war because look what happens. Look what happened to me. But no, he has carved out a political career for himself. You know, that he just probably makes these speeches like a robot now, you know, that he is the voice to counteract the, you know, ineptness and the fecklessness of Barack Obama. And, you know, it's very disturbing to see that when, as I say, this should be cooled down because...
Yeah.
As somebody said, maybe this is, you know, using the metaphor of World War II, maybe the U.S. and Western Europe in stirring this up, maybe this is a bridge too far, that, as someone else put it, that we have run up on a true, you know, we've nibbled away at the satellite states of the former Soviet Union, and, you know, maybe this is the final red line that the Crimean area especially, that Russia will not accept. And Russia is, whether we like it or not, in a resurgent mode, and it has to be, that has to be recognized and respected. And so I think there's going to be negotiations, and then this stuff will have to be hashed out, but it should be hashed out in a cool climate, you know, instead of this hysterical stuff.
Yeah, do you think, because, you know, I read some of the stuff that Graham said. The one tweet sticks out in my mind that this is all happening because of Benghazi. Because they all seem to have this Benghazi fetish.
Benghazi, yeah, look, God, yeah.
But, you know, it's this painting the president as weak, almost pushing him into, you know, to show us that you're tough, you need to do something stupid. So I guess the question is, does he do something stupid?
Well, actually, I think Graham and these people are so cynical that actually what they're doing is they're having great political fun bashing both Putin and Obama. They, you know, they like to bash Putin because he's a thug and takes his shirt off like Mussolini and all this kind of stuff. And then they like to attack Obama because he's the Democratic president and he's a thoughtful guy. He's not a macho guy. And so they attack his manhood in that way, knowing the whole time that we're not going to go to war with Russia. I mean, that is a fact. Everybody knows that, including Putin. You know, something's going to happen, and it, you know, it may be unpleasant, but it's not going to be a war with Russia. So, you know, they have their cake and eat it too. You know, they use this to attack the Democratic president to, you know, raise the star of their political futures, and then they attack Putin because it's great fun to attack Putin. So I think they're pretty cynical, but they're not helping the matter.
You know, I looked at this and it just seemed kind of curious to me. It was only a couple of weeks ago I saw on 60 Minutes they were talking about, you know, some weapon, and I forget what it was. I think it was an aircraft carrier or something that they wanted that I guess has been scrapped because the funding isn't there. And, you know, being kind of cynical and jaded as I am, it just seemed kind of convenient that now this pops up.
Yeah.
Do you think this is an opportunity to start? Because I've been saying, you know, maybe this is the beginning of the arms race part of the Cold War, if you will, where we start spending a whole lot more money on building toys.
Well, you know, Chuck Hagel just, you know, announced this cutback to pre-World War II levels of personnel. Well, to me, that they're not going to cut the budget. Because the budget, you know, JSOC, special ops, drones, cyber warfare, all this stuff of the future that is heavy on intelligence and technology and all that kind of stuff, it's low on manpower. It's just like industry downsizing. You know, we don't need human beings anymore to fight wars. We have robots. We have all these great, as you say, toys. So yes, the budgets for some of these robotics and cyber warfare and you know, mass surveillance of you know, watching everybody, including us, out of fear in the future, because the 21st century is going to be different, as many people have said, that it's not about the decline of the United States of America, which is certainly happening over a slow decline, but it's about the rise of the rest. It's about the rise of China. It's about the rise of India, Brazil, even Russia, the resurgence of Russia after the Soviet Union was crushed. So that we are now being faced with competitors in our own bailiwick of capitalism. And if we don't watch out, you know, they're going to eat our lunch in the 21st century. If we don't, you know, sort of look at ourselves and start empowering ourselves from the bottom up as a resourceful people, instead of just the money all going upwards, you know. So there's real big issues at stake here, and I think this incident with Russia is probably one of the early markers of this kind of thing, where, you know, people, you know, these like here, and this guy was writing Charles King in the New York Times op-ed. He says, it's not the concept of restoring the old Soviet Union that drives somebody like Putin, but it's his commitment to exposing what Russian politicians routinely call the, quote, double standards of American and European foreign policy, and revealing the hidden workings of raison d'etre, the hard-nosed and pragmatic calculation of interest that average citizens from Moscow to Beijing to New Delhi believe drives the policies of all great powers, especially Western powers. In other words, a hypocrisy factor of the United States.
You mean like Kerry saying you can't just invade someone on trumped up on false pretexts, right?
Alas, yes. Like, you know, hey, I mean, look at Cuba, for instance. Look at the invasion of Panama in our hemisphere. You know, we don't like people mucking around in our declared hemisphere. Well, you know, Cuba or Panama were never actually parts of the United States, although Theodore Roosevelt wrenched Panama away from Colombia to build the canal. But Crimea was actually a part of Russia. It had their spiritual roots and mythic roots that go way, way back in Crimea. Not only, you know, the base at, what is it, Sevastopol, you know, where Tolstoy fought, you know, so, you know, this is a very important geographical place for Russians. And, you know, we've sort of mucked with that system. And so, you know, Putin can very easily say, and get a lot of people that resonate with him saying it, that you people are hypocrites. You know, you have done the same thing or worse. I mean, my God, you invaded Iraq. Why? We still don't know why we went into Iraq. And we know all the lies, but we don't know exactly why they really did it.
Wasn't it the aluminum tubes?
Right, of course, right, the aluminum tubes.
Yeah, and look, I can't forget all that stuff. So let me ask you a last question.
Uh-huh.
You know, are we looking at the beginnings of that? Because right when this whole thing in Kiev started,
mm-hmm.
I had asked somebody who had on the program, is this the beginning of going back to my childhood, where you're seeing a place like the Ukraine being the tool that in the tug of war, if you will, between, you know, what was then the Soviet Union, now Russia, and the United States. Is this the game ground?
Right. You know, is this the new East and West Germany, you know?
Right.
Is this the new Iron Curtain, if you will, that runs through now Crimea and Ukraine? God, I don't know. But that is, I think, the question, whether there's sanity in the world and we can sit down and across the table and negotiate with people about these things and come up with a feasible arrangement that the Russians feel comfortable with their keeping a base in you know, Sevastopol and all that in the Crimea, at the same time that Ukraine is allowed to have business, you know, financial arrangements with the West. So that, you know, it can be sort of a border state rather than a strict iron curtain. But you know, with all this polarizing lunacy from our side to counter, you know, Putin's chest thumping, you know, it's, you don't know. Who knows how it will turn out? And of course, that's the big question. And, you know, that a lot of people are wondering right now, including us.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, but it's something I've been wondering for a while.
Yeah.
You know, because look, I mean, Putin is the thug that he is the thug that people think he is. He wants to be able to go in there and with an iron fist put down those protesters.
Yeah. It's important to, in fact, you talk in the criminal world, for instance, and sometimes it overlaps with the political world. You know, the Russian mob and Russian gangsters are considered absolutely the toughest, most ruthless gangsters on the globe. And, you know, I think Putin sort of relishes this, you know, this image of Russians as ruthless and tough. You know, he plays it up in a way. But a lot of times it's true, you know. You know, and you have to recognize that stuff. You don't have to agree with it or accept it as moral. But, you know, you have to face it and deal with it, engage with it.
I think as John Locke said, what is.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't change that. It's just how things work themselves out. And, you know, to be honest, I'm surprised that they haven't, because as I'm learning more, because I think we in this country don't really know much geopolitically, don't spend a lot of time studying these areas. So when, you know, things pop up, you end up getting your information from Sarah Palin going, oh, President Obama's wearing mommy jeans and Putin's a tough guy who drills.
Yeah. President, she said that the president was not potent, like, well, you know, I won't go into what that alludes to, but, you know, I mean, this is Sarah Palin, boy. She goes right for the below the belt, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's really, really nasty stuff. And, yeah, you know.
I mean, the thing that gets me is she could have been vice president. That's what scares me.
Well, I know. It's stunning to think. You know, and, of course, who picked her? John McCain, you know, like, is the man a doddering idiot or what?
You kind of got to wonder on the
remark
on who made that choice.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure he chagrins that decision. That did not reflect well on John McCain.
So I just wanted to get the definitive thought, your thought. Are we seeing the beginnings of what could be the next kind of arms race thing? Because I don't know if you saw today, but the report was that that Russia fired off an ICBM.
I heard that. I heard, in fact, in a more optimistic remark that, you know, they set in the soldiers without any identifying marks, you know, which is very much 21st century, you know, with the stealth this and stealth that, you know, and you know, George Bush saying we don't torture and Putin saying, well, we have no soldiers in when everybody sees them, you know. But I think Putin is much smarter than we probably give him credit for, and that he does not want this to get out of hand. So I think he's using some bluster to make it known that this is very serious for him and other Russians, and that this is where, hopefully, this is what I hope for, that Barack Obama's sort of cautious, lawyerly kind of a survivor, you know, with a pedigree from the Third World, if you will, and that he will have the capacity to negotiate this with John Kerry, and that they will come up with something, you know, that is workable and makes everybody have a little of what they want. But I don't know. Maybe I'm too optimistic. Again, you know, it all depends on personalities and human beings and whether they rise to the occasion.
Yeah, I'm hoping you're right. But at the end of it, I know the Lindsey Graham types, they're going to continue to stoke the fire and cause more grief and more potential trouble. And that's just how I see it.
Yeah. Well, that's real. I agree. Yeah.
But, John, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for me.
Pleasure, Rick. Yeah.
John Grant of Veterans for Peace, Chapter 31. Their website, vetsforpeacephila.org. We'll get a link at therickSmithShow.com. You can also read some of John's writings over at thiscan'tbehappening.net. We'll get links to all of that stuff so you'll have a chance to look at it. And if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone, iTunes, all of that. Right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. You can also email me anytime, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'd love to hear the comments. Are we looking at potentially the next Cold War? I certainly hope not. Some of the indications I've gotten from people like John seem to be that, this is just a little acting up. You know, we'll negotiate it calmly. Maybe it's not going to be like when I grew up as a kid, and I certainly hope not. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, and again, Stitcher on the smartphone. Going to take a quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers President Ed Hill is urging the NLRB to decide for the UAW and the VW Chattanooga plant elections appeal. The UAW wants the NLRB to set aside the results and order a new election. The union says workers could not vote freely due to threats from Tennessee politicians that voting for the union would economically hurt the plant. IBEW President Ed Hill says that his union stands side by side with the UAW in condemning what Hill calls, quote, the gross violation of public trust by the most powerful people in the state, end quote. Hill says the NLRB must protect the right of American workers to decide for themselves how to get the wages and benefits they deserve and the respect they are due. Hill says the NLRB must not reward blackmail. Wisconsin Republicans on Monday held a hearing on a bill that would essentially bar cities and local governments from enacting their own living wage ordinances. The Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice of South Central Wisconsin was among those testifying against the bill. Becky Schiegel is acting director of the coalition.
It doesn't, on paper, void ordinances that cities and counties might make or have made, but what it does is say that you cannot use any state or federal funding in paying wages that you are using on a city contract to uphold a living wage. And because they're talking about shared revenue, it essentially then does make, in fact, local living wages void.
Schiegel says the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice acts on behalf of workers because many major world religions teach justice for workers.
Statements about the dignity of work, about paying fair wages, so many faiths have this, and we come together in a coalition to say in this, in the dignity of a worker, in having a safe work environment and paying people fairly, and of course in trying to lift up people out of poverty. This we all agree on.
On Wednesday, Chicago working families are joining business owners, healthcare practitioners, and Chicago aldermen to call for paid sick days for Chicago workers. The City Hall rally is coming at a time that 82% of Chicago residents support earned paid sick time, according to a recent poll. The paid sick day supporters say 460,000 Chicago workers, 42% of private sector workers in the city, have no paid sick days. That puts workers at risk of being fired or losing pay whenever they're too sick to work. AFT President Randy Weingarten says a new European three-year nursing workforce study confirms that patients die every day because there aren't enough nurses to care for them safely. The RN forecast findings published in Lancet underscore that safe nursing staffing levels reduce medical errors, hospital infections, and patient falls. Weingarten says corporate hospital staff cuts have made the nurse staffing crisis worse.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So early reports today were that the U.S. military had cut off all training exercises, all cooperation, all meetings, any of that stuff with the Russian military. Also, according to our U.S. trade representative, Michael Froman, he says that the U.S. has suspended the upcoming bilateral trade talks and all investment talks with Russia in response to what's going on in the Ukraine. And, you know, talk a little bit more about it and to see what's going on in the region. We covered a little bit of it, but I wanted to get an expert opinion on it, which is why we've asked Russ Bova, a professor of political science and international studies at Dickinson College, to come talk to us. Russ, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, one of the first things when it came up with the protests in Kiev, I had asked the question months ago, is this going to turn into one of these tug-of-wars between the East and West? And I was assured, no, it's much too small for that. But here we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, from the point of view of the Russians and from Vladimir Putin's perspective, Ukraine is really not a small issue. It borders right on Russia. Historically, for more than 300 years, Ukraine was a part of Russia.
Yeah.
And perhaps most importantly from his perspective, well, actually two things important. There are a lot of ethnic Russians who live in Ukrainian territory, and the headquarters of the Russian Black Sea Naval Fleet is located in Ukraine, particularly in the Crimea, where we've seen so much attention focused on the news recently.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, and that was one of the questions I wanted to ask. Why is Crimea different? Well, because I hear a lot of people saying, well, you know, obviously all of the Ukraine was part of Russia, but Crimea especially was something that, that was a little different from what I've been told.
Yeah, it's different. We got to go back. In the days of the former Soviet Union, when we had, you know, the USSR all together, Ukraine was a part of that single country, the Soviet Union. Up until 1954, however, Crimea, this little peninsula in the southern part of the Ukraine that juts out into the Black Sea, was actually a part of the Russian Republic. It was not a part of the Ukrainian Republic, right? So there were 15 republics in the former USSR. Crimea was attached to the Russian Republic, not to Ukraine. 1954, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, in celebrating the 300th year anniversary of the unification of Ukraine with the Russian Empire, decides to make a gift of the Crimea to the Ukraine. Now, back in 1954, when there's a Soviet Union, that doesn't matter very much because Ukraine, Russia, Crimea still are all part of the same single Soviet state.
Right.
Fast forward to 1991, the Soviet Union comes apart, Ukraine becomes an independent country, and all of a sudden, that gift of Crimea to the Ukraine becomes much more important because it's no longer part of Russia.
Right, and that's where they've got a major military base as well.
Absolutely. They have, again, the headquarters of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, right? One of the important fleets of the Russian Navy is located in the port of Sevastopol, which is smack in the middle of Crimea.
So now, as I understand it, and the number of people that I've talked to about this, this section that we're talking about, very pro-Russian.
Yeah, I mean, the population of the Crimea is about 60% Russian. You know, not every Russian who speaks Russian in the Crimea necessarily approves of what Putin's doing here, but this is a very Russian part of what is now, technically speaking, Ukraine.
Because if it were possible, this would be the place where it would be possible. But all the reports that, I should say, all of the reports I've read have said that the Ukrainian people, be it the pro-Russian side or whatever, they want to remain independent.
Well, again, it depends on, you know, depends on which people you're talking to. The further west you go in the Ukraine, the more is the desire to remain independent, in particular, to remain independent of Russia, right? So the further west you go towards the Polish border, the more anti-Russian sentiment you'll find there. The further east you go, however, the more you find sympathy, you know, towards things Russian. You find people whose primary language is Russian, who consider themselves to be ethnic Russians, and at least among those individuals, you know, you'll get different opinions about whether or not an independent Ukraine separate from Russia is either a good thing or a bad thing. So there's not a single opinion among Ukrainians on this question.
Yeah, and looking at this, because I had asked, you know, months ago when I when this first got into the headlines, I said, you know, are we looking at a civil war type thing, something where the country's split in half between East and West, kind of a, you know, East-West Berlin thing? And again, I was told, no, this is much too small for that, and internal conflict and that. Are we looking at that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot is going to depend on what Putin's next move is. Let me give you the nightmare scenario, right? If Putin is satisfied simply with taking Crimea and putting it under Russian control, then I think, you know, the Ukrainians and the international community are very upset, but things kind of linger pretty much as they are now. If Putin, however, decides that that's not enough, that he also wants to bring under his control other parts of eastern Ukraine, where you also have large Russian-speaking populations, then that's a very, you know, then you're talking about a, you know, military invasion in which you're going to see Russian tanks rolling across the border, and that could lead to all kinds of consequences, not just inside Ukraine. That has consequences for Europe and U.S.-Russian relations as a whole.
And pulling us into something that I don't know that anybody's ready for, or because we thought the Cold War was over. This kind of stuff could never happen again.
Yeah, and let me add, I mean, the United States really has very few options in this particular case. We've announced a package of economic measures directed against Russia in response. Yes, we might cut off all, future, Russian-American military cooperation. But I think from the Russian point of view, from Putin's point of view in particular, those are things he can live with. For him, Crimea, the Black Sea Fleet, having a country on his border, which he thinks is going to remain friendly towards Russian interests, is far more important, right, than commercial relations with the United States, which are relatively minor. U.S. commercial relations with Russia are nothing like the kind of thing we have with China.
Right.
Russia can live with that. And the same is true with respect to cutting off, various forms of military cooperation. From Putin's point of view, Crimea trumps all of that. So, the American leverage here, I think, is relatively little. And I don't really think it's a place that the United States is going to go to war. I mean, we're not going to send NATO forces, to defend Crimea or to defend eastern Ukraine from Russian troops. That's simply not going to happen.
I agree, but the thing is it's one of those situations where it's going to show whether the Western world is united, I think.
Well, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And from early indications, not so much. So the poker hand that Putin may be playing may be stronger in his hand than in ours.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Putin, at least in the short term, Putin's hand is strong. Now, in the long term, that's a different set of issues, right? Because there are lots of people in Ukraine, particularly, again, the further west you go, the more this is true, right, who are not interested in a close relationship with Russia, who see themselves as Westerners, who see themselves as Europeans. There's a question of, how he manages a country, a fairly significantly sized country along his border over the long term. This is also a country that is economically in a very difficult, situation. Whoever wins Ukraine wins a prize that it can be very costly to maintain.
Right.
From Putin's point of view, in life, sometimes, you have to be concerned about getting what you wish for, right? If Putin and Russia become responsible for the well-being of Ukraine, that's a pretty expensive proposition.
Well, let me ask you this then, because I see Sarah Palin running around town, and anybody who will listen that she was right about something, and, about energy and drilling and, saying that, Obama wears mommy pants or something and Putin wrestles bears and drills for oil because he's a manly man. Could this be about the gas? I mean, could this be, there was a proposed pipeline deal that I understand to be very lucrative. Could this be part of that?
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, Ukraine, two things. First of all, Ukraine is very dependent on Russian gas to fuel its economy. So Russia has some leverage along those lines. At the same time, the Ukraine is the transit point for getting Russian natural gas to gas-hungry consumers in Western Europe. So the Germans and other West European states import a lot of their gas from Russia through pipelines that go through the Ukraine. So there's a dependence on Russia for the gas, and there's also a dependence on political stability in Ukraine to make sure that those gas supplies aren't interrupted. That said, Russia's leverage here is a little bit less than it was just a few short years ago, precisely because other countries, including the United States, with fracking for natural, for gas and so forth, have become somewhat more energy, I wouldn't say energy independent, but the price of gas has been dropping in response to the more abundant global supply of this important natural resource. And so that puts that reduces a little bit some of the leverage that Putin has, because now there are other alternative sources for West European energy.
Yeah, and again, the first thing I thought of when I saw this was that pipeline. Are we looking at another one of these invasions for oil? Much like I saw Kerry over the weekend on Sunday doing the talking head shows, saying that we shouldn't be invading nations on false pretenses.
No, I mean, I think the American concern, I mean, there's a concern in the West about dependence on Russian gas, right? But again, Ukraine is really just the conduit for the gas. It's not as if, Kiev is sitting on huge, energy resources. Ukraine is simply the place where the pipelines run through to get that gas to Western Europe. Conquering Ukraine doesn't give Western countries any more access to that gas. That gas is still coming from outside the Ukraine in Russia itself. I think the Western interest in Ukraine, you know, is really not so much about energy or about gas. I think it's really more about supporting a people who want independence, who aren't interested in being subservient to their big, you know, neighbor to the east. It's about, you know, staying true to principles of democracy promotion and so forth. And it's about, you know, saying to the Russians that you can't go in and invade your neighbor because you don't like the direction their domestic politics is going.
Right.
I think gas is secondary.
Okay. No, I mean, that's another thought, because that was another line I was going to go in through. Because Putin said that, you know, the guy who was the former Ukrainian president who was kind of pushed aside,
right.
This is Viktor
Yanukovych.
Putin's saying he's still the guy, even though they've stripped him of his power, he's the legitimate head of the country, and basically if he's saying go ahead, there shouldn't be a problem.
I mean, he's, you know, Yanukovych, mind you, right, is nowhere to be seen, right? He's no longer in Kiev. Speculation, you know, that he's still in Russia at this particular point in time. But what Putin's point is simply is that the overthrow of that government, right, was illegitimate. Now, mind you, there was an election in 2010 that brought Yanukovych to power, but it was an election that was not, you know, pristine pure, let's
right.
put it that way, when it comes to the process, you know, through which the election took place. You know, lots of doubts by international observers about the process through which, you know, he was elected, limitations on free speech, free press, and so forth, going to collect the outcome. A former, you know, opposition leader was just released from jail, right? So
yeah, I forget her name as well, but
yeah. So when you're talking about, you know, Ukrainian politics and Ukrainian elections and the legitimacy of Yanukovych as the Ukrainian president, you have to take that with a little bit of a grain of salt, because the elections themselves were not, you know, pristine pure when it comes to their democratic credentials. It's not so much the election, I think. It's really Western reading of the mood in the country. And the mood in much of the country is that this is a country which should not be under Russian domination.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're Russ Bova, professor of political science and international studies at Dickinson College, talking a little about what's going on in the Ukraine. You know, I saw this report today, and I don't know if you saw it or not, that evidently Russia claims that they've successfully test-fired an intercontinental ballistic
yes.
missile.
Yeah.
And you know, some are going, you know, is this, they're creating new ones, whatever our treaties have been. Are we seeing, I guess the big question is, are we seeing the beginning of the ramping up possibly of another Cold War? I know here in the U.S., there's been talk of pulling back on defense spending. So to me, it seems a little curious that this pops up now at a time when we're not going to be building the aircraft carriers and the F-35 stuff that's been going on. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, look, I mean, this particular test, I saw the report, the paper, the Russians claim that this was scheduled. Any event, it wasn't, you know, directly precipitated by the events in Ukraine. Who knows? I mean, you know, countries test missiles on a regular basis. It's conceivable that this was being tested and was scheduled for testing in any particular case. But on your larger question of a new Cold War, you know, it depends what you mean by that. I mean, is this a setback for Russian-American relations? Absolutely, right? I mean, Russian-American relations today are probably worse than at any point since the dissolution of the Soviet Union back in 1991. That said, even this bad relationship between the United States and Russia is not quite the same thing that we had during the Cold War, right? During the Cold War, you had a communist regime in power in the Soviet Union, right, that had a goal of transforming countries far from its borders, you know, on the model of the Soviet political and economic system. It was a country that was spending, you know, maybe a third of its GNP on defense, right? Russia's spending on defense is now about 4.5 to 5% of GNP, and that's of a smaller country, right, and a smaller GNP than you had back in the Soviet days.
Right.
So the size, the power, the lethality of the current Russian army, right, is still not where it was back during the bad old days of, you know, the 70s and the 80s and the Cold War. You know, just to give you another, put this another way, I've seen some commentators referring to Putin as another Hitler. Well, I mean, that neglects the fact, right, that Hitler's military capabilities, you know, in the days leading up to World War II, put him in a position not just to annex a little chunk of a neighboring country. Hitler's military capabilities put him in a position to run roughshod over Central Europe,
yep.
Right? Russia is not in that position, right? Russia could not launch a massive land invasion, you know, of Eastern and Central Europe and have any prospect of succeeding at this point in time. We're talking about, you know, a threat that's very different, certainly from the Nazi threat in World War II, and even very different, I think, from the Soviet threat in the 70s and the 1980s.
So are we seeing this being overblown, in your opinion, then?
No, it's not overblown. It's an important issue. It's simply that we want to put this in perspective, right? We're not talking about, nobody in Washington is worried, as they were during the days of the Cold War, of the Red Army, you know, marching across the plains of Central Europe into Germany, right? Nobody, you know, is thinking in those terms.
Right.
That's not going to happen, right? The threat that we're facing today is real. It's important, but it's a much more limited threat than the kind of threat we were worried about, you know, during the 60s and the 70s. Again, in the 60s and the 70s, our concern that the Red Army was going to try and conquer West Germany, right? That's no longer an issue that's really, you know, keeping people in Washington up at night.
No, I mean, when I was a kid, you had the idea of MAD, you know.
Idea
of mutual assured destruction. That at any minute, you know, it could be the end of it.
Yeah. I don't think we're in that situation at that point. It's bad. It's bad for the relationship. It's certainly bad for the Ukrainians, right? But we're not talking, you know, World War III here.
Well, that's good to begin.
Yeah.
Last question I've got for you, you know, because a lot of blame is being thrown around, and as you pointed out, it's the worst relations we've had with the Russians since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. A lot of people point the fingers at Obama, and I point to a tweet by Lindsey Graham, who claims that it all started with Benghazi. He says, when you kill Americans and nobody pays a price, you invite this type of this aggression, hashtag Ukraine. I'm curious your thoughts on that sentiment.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, it's hard to know what's going through Putin's mind, whether or not he's taking that, you know, into the calculation. I mean, Syria could be another place, right? Remember in Syria, the more recent example where Obama draws a red line and then seems, you know, unprepared, right, to act on that red line once it's crossed. So it's certainly possible that this is part of the calculation. But I think in the case of Crimea, I think we'd be seeing this in any case, right? Whoever was in the White House would not have any particular leverage over Putin in this particular case. You know, whether it's Lindsey Graham or Obama or Hillary Clinton or John McCain or Mitt Romney, the kinds of policy leverage that we have in response to what Putin is doing in Ukraine was going to be very limited, right? And there's only so much that a particular individual in the White House, right, can do to overcome the facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground are, in the Crimea, Russia already had think about it, right? They were able to, in effect, take over the Crimea without sending tanks across the border. Why? Because you already have Russian troops in the Crimea, right?
Yeah.
We don't have any American troops in that, in that region. There was really nothing that any American president, you know, Democrat or Republican, was going to be able to do to stop this. And I think for Putin, the reason he does this is because he sees the Russian position in the Crimea under threat, right? It has, I think, Benghazi, Syria, other things maybe make him a little bit more confident, but I don't think are the difference in terms of whether he acts or not.
Well, kind of where my thought process was, but I appreciate the time, and I appreciate your expert insight. Thanks so much.
No problem. Take care.
Thanks so much, Russ Bova, professor of political science and international studies at Dickinson College. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Rex Tillerson is mad. In fact, fracking mad.
This 61-year-old farmer from Bartonville, Texas, is another victim of big oil fracking boom that's invaded people's homes and lives from upstate New York to Southern California. Polluted air, contaminated water, depleted aquifers, multiple health problems, and even an inexplicable epidemic of earthquakes are a few of the side effects caused by this massively destructive drilling process. But the frackers had not counted on Rex getting mad, speaking out, and suing the bastards. What ticked off Tillerson was the erection of a 160-foot-tall water tower built by a company that can provide millions of gallons of water for fracking gas wells. But Rex is no environmentalist, so his objection is not to the waste and contamination of people's water, nor does he object at all to fracking. Rather, he's hopping mad because the 15-story tower stands above the tree line on his 83-acre, $5 million horse farm, spoiling his view. Tillerson, you see, is not just some local dirt farmer. He says he and his wife moved here to have a weekend getaway so they can enjoy the rural lifestyle. He's not a farmer at all, unless you count farming the government and harvesting billions of dollars in special tax breaks and subsidies. Rex, whose name means king in Latin, is the $40 million a year CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, guess which oil giant is the biggest fracker in the USA? Right, ExxonMobil. This is Jim Hightower saying, so what we have here is a case of phallic justice. An upright, cylindrical water tower that's part of the fracking infrastructure, symbolically extending the middle finger salute to Exxon CEO every time he visits his horsey farm. How fitting that a guy who's gained a personal fortune from the ugliness of fracking now has some of that ugliness right in his face. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lyons. The right-wing's Benghazi scandal-mongering entered the realm of self-parody after Fox News let Senator Lindsey Graham blame the Russian invasion of Ukraine on the 2012 attacks in Benghazi, the latest conservative attempt to turn tragedy into political gold. During Fox News' On the Record with Greta Van Susteren, Graham brought up his Benghazi accusations repeatedly on the air.
But you said that the president has a weak and indecisive policy that invites aggression.
Right. This is a symptom of a greater problem. It really, in many ways, started with Benghazi. When our consulate was overrun and our first ambassador was killed in 30-something years in the line of duty, three other brave Americans died and not one person's been held accountable. You're sending absolutely the wrong signal to our foes around the country.
The bizarre claim was swiftly ridiculed by even conservative pundits online, but it didn't even seem to register with the Fox host. That's hardly surprising. Right-wing attempts to smear political opponents with Benghazi attacks have been disconnected from reality for some time. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. I think we've got that all worked out. Also, iTunes, all of that stuff. Or you can just go to the website and watch it live with our YouTube link. Gotten some pretty good response back from that. Our quote of the day, again, I've used this earlier in the program, but I think it bears repeating today. And his inaugural address, President Thomas Jefferson said, "Take not from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned." And, you know, you can look at that a couple of ways. Now, the right spins that as, well, we can't tax. I look at it a couple of different ways. One, we shouldn't be overtaxing working people. I agree. But two, you know, the wages that they earn, the wealth that they create, they should be able to share in. And, you know, someone asked me over the weekend who my favorite president was, and immediately I said John Adams. Only because the very first, and the most amazing moment in U.S. history, really, the very first bloodless change of power. The very first, and I think in the history of civilization, which is what set this country in motion to be what it has become. I'm not a fan of the Adams presidency, but you got to give the guy credit that he believed in the idea of the country and the idea of self-rule and the idea of a voting populace. You gotta respect that. And I do. Also, our quote paragraph of the day, if you will, someone sent me this, you know, in talking about, because occasionally I'll throw up Adam Smith because the right wing kind of has taken over Adam Smith and turned him into this free marketeer that laissez-faire capitalism would have, you know, that was his goal. The market. Now, in his book, An Inquiry into the Nature and the Causes of the Wealth of Nations, Book 1, Chapter 2, on the principles which give occasion to the division of labor, he writes, the difference of natural talents in different men is, in reality, much less than we are aware of, and the very different genius that appears to distinguish men of different professions when grown up to maturity is not upon many occasions so much the cause as the effect of the division of labor. The difference between the most dissimilar characters, between the philosopher and the common street porter, for example, seem to arise not so much from nature as from habit, custom, and education. When they came into the world, and for the first 6 or 8 years of their existence, they were perhaps very much alike. And, you know, I read that, and I appreciate someone sending it to me. I read this as, you know, opportunity. That beginning, we're all equal. It's what opportunities do you want to have? What educational chances do you have? What do you have in the home to help push you in the right direction? You know, to me, that's what it's about. And I think we can, through policy, through smart investment, help folks, you know, like me, when I grew up as a kid in a high poverty area, have a chance, a helping hand at moving forward. So this idea that we gut all of the assistance programs just seems wrongheaded on so many levels. Anyway, let's take a quick break, right back, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the dog.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers President Ed Hill is urging the NLRB to decide for the UAW in the VW Chattanooga plant elections appeal. The UAW wants the NLRB to set aside the results and order a new election. The union says workers could not vote freely due to threats from Tennessee politicians that voting for the union would economically hurt the plant. IBEW President Ed Hill says that his union stands side by side with the UAW in condemning what Hill calls, quote, the gross violation of public trust by the most powerful people in the state, end quote. Hill says the NLRB must protect the right of American workers to decide for themselves how to get the wages and benefits they deserve and the respect they are due. Hill says the NLRB must not reward blackmail. Wisconsin Republicans on Monday held a hearing on a bill that would essentially bar cities and local governments from enacting their own living wage ordinances. The Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice of South Central Wisconsin was among those testifying against the bill. Becky Schiegel is acting director of the coalition.
It doesn't, on paper, void ordinances that cities and counties might make or have made, but what it does is say that you cannot use any state or federal funding in paying wages that you are using on a city contract to uphold a living wage. And because they're talking about shared revenue, it essentially then does make, in fact, local living wages void.
Schiegel says the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice acts on behalf of workers because many major world religions teach justice for workers.
Statements about the dignity of work, about paying fair wages, so many faiths have this, and we come together in a coalition to say in this, in the dignity of a worker, in having a safe work environment and paying people fairly, and of course in trying to lift up people out of poverty. This we all agree on.
On Wednesday, Chicago working families are joining business owners, healthcare practitioners, and Chicago aldermen to call for paid sick days for Chicago workers. The City Hall rally is coming at a time that 82% of Chicago residents support earned paid sick time, according to a recent poll. The paid sick day supporters say 460,000 Chicago workers, 42% of private sector workers in the city, have no paid sick days. That puts workers at risk of being fired or losing pay whenever they're too sick to work. AFT President Randy Weingarten says a new European three-year nursing workforce study confirms that patients die every day because there aren't enough nurses to care for them safely. The RN forecast findings published in Lancet underscore that safe nursing staffing levels reduce medical errors, hospital infections, and patient falls. Weingarten says corporate hospital staff cuts have made the nurse staffing crisis worse.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
You know, I got to be honest. You know, I use Facebook, I use Twitter, I use all that stuff. But this is one of those times where you go, really? Was this the best use that you could come up with, the use of Facebook? Evidently, an 18-year-old girl went on Facebook and decided that she was going to tell all of her friends that the father, and evidently the father had worked at this private school. And as part of an age discrimination suit, he sued, won a settlement of about $80,000. So she went on Facebook, couldn't hold it back anymore. She wrote, "Mama and Papa Snay won the case against Gulliver. Gulliver is now officially paying my vacation to Europe this summer," with the good punchline, "Suck it!" Turns out some of her 1,200 Facebook friends and followers, former students who went back to the school, and, well, the lawyers went in and said, nope, took it to court, and there's these weird little gag orders that you can't talk about it, can't even say that you settled. Well, they took the money back. So I got to wonder how that's going to go at the next big family function. So there you go. I think there's got to be a better use for Facebook than that. Anyway, tons of Facebook shares here recently over Sunday's John Kerry conversations, and here to talk a little bit more about what's going on around the world. In Washington, D.C., I got Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks. I wonder if she's going to go in timeout for the next 20 years.
I would assume if there a corporal punishment is in order.
Well, or she's told, hey, by the way, when you're 18, this is the money you would have had.
or this was your college education gone goodbye.
Right.
But, you know, and speaking of Facebook shares, I know Kerry over on Sunday did the Talking Head shows, and he had really, really just a very bizarre comment. Stating that, well, you know, he said, you don't in the 21st century behave in 19th century fashion by invading another country on completely trumped up pretexts. He finished it off by saying, you just don't invade another country on phony pretext in order to assert your interests. And I gotta be honest, there's some irony in there, don't you think?
A lot. You know, when I have been asked what I am most ashamed of or regretful for, everybody expects the first thing to be, you know, Jack Abramoff. The first thing I'm regretful for is that whole vote on giving full authority, you know. We were lied to, but full authority to George Bush, and then they lied to Colonel Powell, he lied to the UN indirectly, you know, et cetera. And it made me cringe when I saw Secretary of State Kerry, and I think he's done a pretty good job, but Rick, I cringed.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I thought of is aluminum tubes. That was literally the first thing that popped into my head, aluminum tubes.
And then also Valerie Flame, you know, yellow cake. I mean, you can go on and on and on. And, of course, then people say, well, we invaded because he was a bad man. So is the premier of China. I don't remember us going into Beijing.
Yeah. Well, and so's the guy.
It made me cringe.
So's the guy who's now taking over Crimea.
Exactly.
And, you know, I look at what's going on, and, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people. You know, is this the beginning of a new Cold War? What do you get the sense in D.C. right now about Putin's move to take over Crimea and really to kind of muscle his way into the eastern part of the Ukraine?
Well, let's go first to the people who like to use a good crisis to get more toys, you know, for the military. So let's go to John McCain just for a second, who says, you know, who couldn't answer actually on the morning show, and they said, well, what would you do? And he just stumbled all over the place.
Yeah.
But he said, well, you know, we need to be more defense money. For what? I mean, if we had 1,000 more nukes, would Putin have sat, you know, in Russia and done nothing? No. So you've got that element. Then you've got the blame game. Barack Obama is too weak. Well, George Bush loved Putin, and George Bush was there when Georgia was invaded, you know. So you've got that element. Then you've got the real substance of, you know, what do people think? And Putin, they know. I think the people in D.C., you know, from what I picked up from friends, too, that they know deep down that Putin's playing a chess game. We can send aid, the $1 billion, to the Ukraine, but as far as the sanctions, they're worthless from us. The European Union, which has a lot more authority with Russia, a yep. lot more interaction, and a lot more to lose, both sides over there, they're not going to do sanctions, Rick. So what Capitol Hill knows is Putin is, you know, Putin's in the driver's seat on this thing. Now, in the long run, he may really have bitten off more than he can chew, and he may be in a predicament of an exit plan. But I think he's looking for some type of appeasement, some type of deal out of the European Union. Now, he's got his fingers over there on the coast where he wants them, and he, you know, he stays with a certain amount of troops there.
Well, but I understand they have a massive base there anyway. Their big naval base is right there, and you know, the reality in it of is you know, I don't know why you would have taken it over or caused this other than if there is some type of North Korean style, hey, give me something.
Well, yes, and then if one looks at the skirmish that occurred actually today in the last 24 hours, which was, you know, some shots potentially fired, et cetera, and the people that were trying to go to the base, military base, were not trying to take it over. They were trying to go to work. You know, so you have an economic element there.
Right.
And a lot of this is economics. There's a pipeline that's running through the Ukraine. Russia is, beyond Saudi Arabia, is the Saudi Arabia of oil and all the natural gas pipelines. So, you know, Putin is not only culturally in his KGB nature is trying to, you know, do some things in an aggressive manner. He has an economic situation. I'm not saying he's, you know, the best guy on earth. He has supposedly a treaty. Ukraine says he doesn't, but he can put up to 26,000 troops in there, according to a treaty that might be faulty, and it might have been with, you know, the wrong people that ran to Ukraine, but he's got it.
Yeah. I go back to Bush, and, you know, I looked into his eyes, and we knew we were soulmates. Saw his soul.
On another note, I can tell you, I was on Air Force One with President Bush and about 9 other members of Congress right after the first election, and we were flying from Andrews Air Force Base. And he spent a great portion of that flight, I can recall very clearly, Rick, just going on and on about Putin, and he made a joke about how he could say his name because his wife taught him how to say it. And he just raved about this wonderful man, the bastion of democracy, his working partner, you know, for world peace.
Wow. And what I see now coming out of the Republican Party is you got people like Lindsey Graham saying, oh, it's all because of Benghazi. All this is Benghazi.
You know, you've got, I mean, if they want to try to relate something, they can try to relate Syria, but it's not due to Syria. You know, actually, Russia pulled us out of the Syria mess, let's face it. But Benghazi has no relationship whatsoever to this, I mean, not even a hint of a relationship to this thing.
Wow. It makes for a good rhetoric, though. That's because they were weak. And because that's been the frame right now, hasn't it? All this is happening because, and this is what blows my mind about the Republicans, who right now are the ones who have been saying, well, you know, we don't want to look weak on defense. So then why are you trying to weaken the guy even further?
When you look at this, too, I call it the gaga over toys. And I say that because we had guys in the Congress that would just go crazy. We need this new weapon. We need that new weapon. And they'll use a crisis like that. Well, we need to be stronger. They're not even talking about troop strength. They're talking about defense contractors. They're talking about, you know, those are jobs in their districts.
Yep.
And there's a lot of guys out there, Rick, that are just crazy over weaponry. You know, you've seen one nuke war, you've seen them all, and how many more nukes? Like I said, if we had 500 more nukes, would that have stopped Putin from doing what he did?
Absolutely not.
And we're not going to use them.
You know, the thing that gets me is that, you know, a lot of things seem curious. I'm not a conspiratorial type person, but it just seems curious that while we're talking about ramping down military spending and we're talking about doing some other things, you know, maybe not building this this aircraft carrier or this airplane or this gadget or whatnot, that this just kind of pops up and, you know, kind of pokes a stick at that. And you know, as you said, you know right now somebody's going to hit the floor going, hey, we need to have the latest, greatest whatnot widget, and this is why.
And if you look back at 911, when they talked about should we have shot the, you know, those planes down, and that there were not jets close enough, and I'm using this as an example because it was said that Bill Clinton, due to not providing enough defense money, that we didn't have jets armed with bombs, with weaponry that could have gotten to those planes headed to the Capitol and the Pentagon and the towers. We could have got to them quicker if he'd have just had better defense budget. That was said.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's absolutely ridiculous.
But it wasn't said in the opposite here with Benghazi then. If we had a bigger budget, that they would have been able to get the people in to help. That wasn't the Republican rhetoric that I've read. Because they would have to take ownership of it.
Well, they voted to cut it not too long ago. They had it, you know, in,
right.
to not provide the money.
All the screw quester and all of that stuff.
Exactly.
All right, let's move along. I guess the IRS has got a new ruling out that should inflame the conservative types.
Well, this one, yes, and they might get a little bit of support from the liberal side on this one, because this will kind of cut across both, let's say, the patriotic majority, which is a liberal leaning group, and also the conservative crossroads. But the IRS is doing a rule, and it's very interesting because the Federal Elections Commission usually would do this type of rule. But the IRS and the Treasury have proposed a new standard, and what they would say, they would apply it to groups regardless of political affiliation. They would classify any communication within 60 days of a general election that identifies a candidate or a party or some get-out-of-the-vote effort as political. Now, you know, people that raise money are not going to like this, because you can't use a candidate's name, or you can't say call your congressman and tell he or she not to vote for this or that. Now, the House passed a bill. This is where the Democrats and Republicans got together last week to delay these regulations.
Okay. Yeah, because they both want their you know, their ground troops behind them. And look, to me, I don't even know why the IRS is involved in this. You know, shouldn't this be the purview of the FEC?
Absolutely. This should be Federal Elections Commission, the use of it. But the IRS, and it sort of plays into the hands, although you're not going to see the Republicans attack them as much, you know, for this. They don't want the rule. But this sort of plays into, you know, the IRS and these groups. Of course, we know they went after all groups equally. But it sort of plays into the IRS, quote, tinkering with causal groups, you know, issue groups.
No, and I've said from the beginning, none of them should get tax breaks. We should stop with all of these insane tax breaks for these special interests. You want to go and you want to advocate, you pay for it. It should be that simple in my view. Same thing with the church deductions, which is not, I don't have a lot of support here, but I think all of these tax deductions we're giving out just seems dumb to me. Pay your taxes like everybody else.
Well, it's like vouchers too. When the private schools wanted vouchers, but when you take a voucher, you take the government's finger into your system, and you'll take government rules and regs. So if you don't want the government in your business, then you don't take the voucher. And if these groups, if they're truly a cause group, they should be able to raise money. And I agree with you. They should be able to raise money without having to say, hey, let's support this great cause for health care, but I know you're not going to do it unless you get a tax break.
No, it's... All of these tax breaks for this stuff just seems dumb to me. And I said it from the start. When everyone was screaming, oh, they're targeting people, they should be targeting the groups that are trying to get this stuff. If you've got a huge influx of one side, guess who's being examined more heavily because there are more of them. as it should be. This is just ridiculous to me. What's going on with the budget? I know the president came out yesterday with his budget idea, and then Ryan with his anti-poverty program piece of nonsense. What's the feel in D.C.?
Well, there's a few things. The State Department will receive about $4.6 billion to protect the staffs at the consulates. That's in the president's budget. Mental health will receive an increase, especially after the multiple mass shootings in recent years. So it does outline about $75 million for mental health programs, specifically for youth and young adults. And then from welfare to work, now the president receives a lot of flack from political adversaries for bolstering the, quote, nanny state and creating a culture of dependency, et cetera. But in this budget, he proposes redirect about $600 million to a program that works with employers, and they'll provide subsidized employment opportunities for low-income people. Unemployment benefits, of course, and a few other issues there, international AIDS program. The president did attempt for a while, with the chained
CPI.
Social Security. He attempted to do some outreach to the Republicans, but I think they found out that's just useless. And Ryan will do his budget, and the Senate, by the way, Rick, is not even going to do one. They're going to wait.
Now they're going to wait till after to see how the election in November fleshes out.
That's right.
Because the Republicans actually think they've got they may have a shot of controlling the Senate.
I think a mistake, we were talking about advocacy groups and the money spent in the IRS and all that, but the advocacy groups and the money people are, and unless this is reversed on the Democratic side, are making a mistake of, quote, writing the House off and putting the whole ball of wax on the Senate. That allows for too much money play in Washington. So I think on the Democratic side, it's going to take some powerful people like the president and others to say, wait a minute, this is... The money just doesn't go to one entity.
Yep, I agree.
If you overreach, they would be in danger of losing more seats in the House. But, it's a long way off with the Senate, and we've got to see what happens yet. But I think the Senate's a form of play, of course.
Now, we'll see how this all plays itself out. I'm looking forward to it. And finally, some information on BP. What's going on with our big oil friends?
Yes, BP is not happy, which should probably make a lot of people, I would assume, happy. And there was a court ruling. It was a district court ruling. And BP is going to have to pay. It must pay. And it's a setback for BP. It deals with the aftermath of 2010, of course, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the company's efforts to halt payments to claimants. The company was arguing, BP, strenuously in court and in the newspaper ads, that the settlement has been unfairly misinterpreted, and it was being forced to pay for damage unrelated to the incident. But the judge strongly worded that the company was bound by the agreement it signed itself, and it estimated costs to run $7.8 billion, and it's now $9.2 billion, and they're not happy about that. So they've lost this round in the appeals court.
Oh, I'm broken up about it.
I know. I feel bad.
I won't sleep tonight. I
think I'll maybe have a tank of gas tomorrow.
And then you'll pay for it for him. That's so
right.
Nice of you, Bob. Always great talking with you, Bob.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional. unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
I tell you, I'm kind of saddened that I didn't hear any insanity come out of Michelle Bachmann. You heard the Sarah Palin. You heard her running around going, I was right about something. I was right. And, although, you know, to be honest, take a genius. Really? Didn't take anyone really all that bright? Look, when it first started, everything going on over in the Ukraine, I was going, you know, hey, this not good. There could be trouble here. Didn't take a genius to figure it out. Really didn't. So again, you know, not for nothing, Sarah. Not and you gotta imagine that she's got some very well paid some strategists, some people going, hey, here's what you should say, puppet. Just is what it is. Anyway, during the break, I got an email from George, who points out. He said, you know, I heard your piece yesterday on the guy you were talking to on how he claims you can just go across the street and find a job somewhere else if you didn't like how things were. He said, I remember this article that you should hand him. And what he did, he sent me a LinkedIn article over to the New York Times on the titled Engineers Allege Hiring Collusion in Silicon Valley. And the bottom line is the way the article looks out, from 2005 to 2009, evidently over, you know, in Silicon Valley, there was an agreement, I guess, brokered from what the allegation is brokered by Steve Jobs, that they wouldn't steal people from each other. They had this agreement that, you know, hey, this is what's being alleged, that there was an agreement that, you know, if you worked for Apple or you worked for Google or whoever, that if you went looking for another job, they weren't hiring you. And the idea, you know, this is just how the article goes, that you look at the some 64,000 programmers are involved in this case, and they're seeking billions of dollars in damages for, you know, doing just what this guy said I can do. I can just go across the street. I'm a smart guy. I can go work for Google or Apple or who knows whoever. I can go do this, and they'll pay me, and I'll make more money. No, there's this kind of little collusion kind of thing going on, saying, no, you're not going to do that. And, you know, Paul Krugman had an interesting statement on it, you know, saying that, you know, the reality is, and again, he went back to, you know, the reason I think this is interesting now is, you know, I just quoted Adam Smith a minute ago. Paul Krugman writes a bit where he quotes Adam Smith as well, where Smith said, people of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in the conspiracy against the public. And you look at this and you go, yeah, it's called collusion. You know, it's called, we won't let the wages get too high because we don't want to pay those high labor costs. So much for the argument that the free market dictates. So much for that. Anyway, thanks for joining us tonight. If you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go get the podcast, Stitcher, smartphone, email rick@thericksmithshow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide that flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
In recent years, former State Department official P.J. Crowley tells Rachel Maddow that vulnerability may curtail Europe's appetite for a strong international response, particularly in Germany.